Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anaheim, California! We are Ender, and we'll see you guys soon! Oh, no!
That is not too shabby. Hinder, live at the House of Blues in Anaheim, California, was recorded by Westwood One Mobile. Biff Dawes, engineer, assisted by Doug Field, Phil Kneebone, and Jay Resnick. In studio reduction by Steven Sugar Bear Cosio. The guys are currently on the road, so check out their website for tour dates and some of their off-the-wall contests. Speaking of off-the-wall, this particular program is written and reduced by Fred Lindgren. Executive pimp is Norm Pattis. High Voltage is a presentation of Westwood One and was brought to you by The Voodoo Experience, Nine Inch Nails, R.E.M., and STP. Good show there, October 24th through the 26th, New Orleans, The Voodoo Experience. Go to thetenthritual.com. Until next time, I'm Nick Carter. Peace out, bitches.
101.1 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to a special... Well, I ruined that, didn't I? A special edition of Night Call, laughing at me as she should, laughing with me, Jillian Jordan, my co-host. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, Peter. Good to be here. And it is a special
edition.
Yeah. We're live.
Absolutely astounding to me that, what are those people's names? Oh, yeah. John McCain and Sarah Palin.
Oh.
Although McCain has like almost disappeared. We'll talk a little about Sarah Palin and her extended 15 minutes of fame. But why this one is different, most of you know, have been listening a long time. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, I play a couple of interviews that I recorded previously with authors or people that comment on the world, the news, our state of affairs, whatever. I was able, in fact, pretty easily, to get an interview with Bill Ayers. He's the ex-weather underground figure who the McCain-Palin campaign tried to tie Barack Obama to, saying that Barack Obama had palled around with terrorists, plural, when actually they meant singular, which in the figure of Bill Ayers. Well, I've known Bill Ayers for a long time, so it wasn't too difficult for me to get an interview with him. He'd already been on Good Morning America, where I saw him. He comported himself very nicely with, is it Philip Cuomo? Is that, anyways, the host.
I don't know his name.
Yeah, Phil Cuomo, I think. Yeah. And then also with Terry Gross on NPR. So I said, man, I got to get with Bill before he's,
burned out. Yeah.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to play the interview that I did with Bill Ayers, ex-Weather Underground figure, and get that in your mind. He's, you know, this, a terrorist quote, as Palin tried to paint him. I guess McCain as well. And actually Hillary did as well. Started talking about what is his relationship.
But
She started it all. Yeah, actually. Yeah, shame on her.
So disappointing.
Yeah. So, Bill Ayers, well, maybe we just ought to play it because I take up some of those questions.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So here it is. Well, I'll just introduce myself. All right. And in the meantime, if you want to call in and comment on this, I'd like to hear what you think about it. Someone said, don't you think it's a little inappropriate to have him on? And I'm thinking, well, they could do it on Good Morning America.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. No. No what?
It's not inappropriate.
No, it's not inappropriate.
I don't think it is.
All right, so...
313-298.
WRIF. All right. We'll be right back, and this is about 23 minutes long.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. As you know, if you're a regular listener, I do a lot of shows on education because we all know how important education is to our future and what bad shape it's in. And if I was doing a show with this guest that I will soon introduce, I would say he's a distinguished professor of education and senior university scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, that he founded both the Small Schools Workshop and the Center for Youth and Society, that he teaches courses in interpretive and qualitative research, urban school change, and teaching and the modern predicament. He has worked with Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago in a wide range of aspects of education, school reform agenda, was responsible for bringing $50 million to the school system, and in 1997 was named Citizen of the Year in Chicago. His articles and books are so numerous that it would take too long to mention. And then I would introduce Professor Bill Ayers, but we know him better as the man who the Republican ticket of John McCain and Sarah Palin tried to win the presidential election on. Bill Ayers, who is probably so well known to people now that he would almost say he needs no introduction. But I'm proud to say he's a man that I've palled around with. Bill Ayers, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's good to be here.
What a surprise that somehow, after all these years, that rather, and all the work you've done on behalf of schools and children during a lifetime of educational work, that your 15 minutes of fame resurrects something that happened 35, 40 years ago. How does that all make you feel?
Well, it was surreal while it was going on, I have to tell you, but I chose early on not to get involved in the conversation because I felt that it was such a dishonest conversation that I didn't want any part of it. I mean, every aspect of the narrative was a lie, and I decided to turn away from that. And I'm very, very delighted at the outcome, and I'm delighted that while I was invented as a caricature to hurt the candidacy of Barack Obama, it turned out, ironically, that it hurt the candidacy of John McCain.
Now, the charge was, out of the mouth of Sarah Palin, that that Barack Obama had palled around with you, Bill Ayers, a terrorist from the 1960s and 70s. You used to talk about a dishonest narrative. What in that characterization is dishonest?
Well, there are three dishonesties right on the face of it. One is that you have to believe that I'm a monster, first of all, in order to have that thing have any traction. And I felt a little bit, as the thing went along, like the character in 1984 who was thrust up on the screen, the enemy of the party, and the faithful would gather around and chant, kill him, kill him. I was not Emmanuel Goldstein. I am not a monster, and I'm not a frightening person. So that narrative was part of the dishonesty, the demonization of me. But it seems to me a more difficult and a more potentially dangerous dishonesty is the idea that if two people sit together in a boardroom or have a conversation or share a bus ride downtown or any of a thousand other associations, that association is in itself dangerous. It's the whole guilt by association number. It's a terrible part of our history. And here it was being used. My response to that is every one of us should spend more time speaking with people we disagree with, talking to a wide range of people. And that should go double for our political leaders. They should listen widely. They should talk to everyone. And at the end of the day, they should have a mind of their own. And it seems to me Obama is a case in point.
I was listening to you, Bill Ayers, being interviewed by Terry Gross on National Public Radio, and she was playing some of the McCain-Palin ads that were solely, I mean, I was astounded. I don't watch much television, so I'd never seen these, that they used 30 and 60 seconds of precious time in which they could have spoken about issues that affect all of us, and instead it was about Bill Ayers, this terrorist that connected with Barack Obama. How did that sit in your, I mean, you did describe it, but as more of a surface in public manner. I mean, Bill Ayers inside, I mean, were you shocked, surprised, frightened? What was your response to all of a sudden being thrust into the public in such a negative way?
Well, like you, I don't watch much television and I don't pay much attention. And I also have somehow a capacity to disassociate myself from the kind of cartoon character that was being created. I did get a lot of the news because, well, in two ways, really. I have three grown sons and they would send me occasional pieces, not to upset me, but just to kind of tell me what was going on. And I do watch The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, and they kept having me up as a character, mostly to make fun of what the McCain-Palin people were doing. But I think you make a very important point, and that is that they had spent millions and millions of dollars in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. And what was the big message? The big message was, here's a mystery man, Barack Obama. He charms everybody, but what do we really know about him? And it was that kind of dark sense that there was this secret relationship with a fiery preacher or a Palestinian scholar or an unrepentant, in McCain's terms, toothless old radical. All of that is, it seems to me, dangerous to democracy. I want our political candidates to talk to all of us. We're a wild, diverse society. Let's get out there and talk. It felt strange, Peter, but it also felt ineffective. And I thought, boy, are they bankrupt if this is all they can come up with.
Yeah, that was about it. And why do you think it didn't work? I mean, why weren't you the Willie Horton of where this, if people may not know of this, in 1988, the first George Bush ran this this terrible racist ad, and that it actually, many people think that it won the presidency for him. Why didn't Bill Ayers and the, you know, palling around, in quotes, with Barack Obama, why didn't that, in fact, have the opposite result? People did not like that.
Well, you know, I think I optimistically, I think that it's a very hopeful sign that the American people rejected kind of the Richard Nixon anti-communist playbook when it was pulled out and implemented in full. And I think that's a hopeful thing. I speculate that I think generationally, none of this stuff had any traction with young people. I mean, what did it all mean, this kind of stirring the pot? Or as Stephen Colbert one night, he made his special word of the day, the 60s, and he opened the bit by having Barack Obama say, can't we just get over the 60s? And it comes back to a scolding Stephen Colbert saying, no, Senator, we can't get over the 60s. It's the gift that keeps on giving. And I think it was very funny, and I think that is kind of what the right-wing playbook was based on, was let's refight these irrelevant culture wars. Let's resurrect the 60s as a whipping boy. And they did it in two ways. One was the character of Bill Ayers. The other was the character of a fiery black preacher who actually is an extraordinary man, an extraordinary leader in Chicago. And here they reduced the entire black freedom movement to one church, one sermon, one minister. It was unconscionable. And I think it's great that it didn't work. Now, I say that with a little reservation. I think we're probably seeing the last time that the 60s will be waved as a bloody shirt in an election. That's good because it's a generational shift, because nostalgia for the 60s is so boring, because we can't replay events that happened 40 years ago. The only bad part, I would argue, is that we've never learned the lessons of the war in Vietnam broadly as a culture. It would be useful to learn those lessons. We've never discussed broadly as a culture, as a people, what the victories and the limits of the Black Freedom Movement were. So I think we're squandering an opportunity here to have some truth-telling and some reconciliation of those years. But all in all, we're probably moving on, and that's a good thing.
It is a good thing indeed. You're listening to the Peter Werbe Show. My guest is Bill Ayers, and his title now is Distinguished Professor of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Resurrected or erected, imposed upon us during the last election campaign as the man that Barack Obama palled around with. Also, there's been a reissue of Bill Ayers' memoir, Fugitive Days, Memoirs of an Anti-War Activist. It's published by Beacon. It has a new afterword by Bill. And the only thing, the only thing I was a little disappointed in, I thought, how did he get this out so quickly after the election? Actually, your afterword for the paperback edition of Fugitive Days, your life in the weather underground during the 1970s, was written in July of this year. Do you wish, or is there another afterword in the works?
Well, the other afterword that's in the works is that Bernadine Dorn, who has been my partner for 40 years, and I just wrote a book called Race Course Against White Supremacy, and that book will be out next month by Third World Press, and that has an afterword that was written on November 5th, 2008, and that begins with partying in Grant Park, which we did. So that book, look for that book. I think it's an important book, and I think that's a memoir of 40 years of jointly fighting against racism. And I'll tell you something. I mentioned that we've been together a long time. Writing a book together is a real test. It's harder than putting together a piece of IKEA furniture or anything else I've done. But it was worthwhile, and I think that we came out with a book that'll be useful.
Well, for sure. Send it to me, and I will interview Bernadine Dorn.
Oh, maybe we'll both come on. That would be fun. Maybe okay. We'll come to Detroit. We'll both be on.
Absolutely. Now, I said on my show in the run-up to the election, I said when Barack Obama wins, because I had no question in my mind that he was going to win. I mean, it's not that I'm so bright. I was looking at all the polls, not the ones on Fox News, but the one that showed all the electoral votes. And 3 weeks before, they had Barack Obama with 333 electoral votes projected. So I thought it was a done deal. So I said Barack Obama should appoint Bill Ayers as Secretary of Education, which, of course, was just my extreme way of, expressing solidarity with you, but also to say, hey, McCain and Palin, this does not work. But you know what? And this is something that will bring out what I'm going to say. You're one of the more modest people that I know, that given the number of achievements that you've done in your academic and educational career. But you actually would make a terrific Secretary of Education, but I don't think Barack Obama is going to make that appointment.
I appreciate your saying so, but you know, one of the things I am constantly reminding young people of today is that we don't need to spend a lot of time reading Barack Obama's mind, but what we do need to do is to make sure that we don't give up on taking this wonderful moment of expanding imaginations, of rising expectations, and try to redefine some of the issues that we've been stuck in. One is education. The idea that education is a competitive matter and that it's all about winners and losers and that we can understand what an educated person is from standardized tests and that it's career training. All of that is backward, and in my view, we've suffered under it too long. I want to push for a view of education that's much more in the spirit of democracy, that is, education in which we understand that the full development of all is the condition for the full development of each, and that we see each human being as of incalculable value. I think we can win that argument today, whoever is Secretary of Education. It really demands kind of activists on the ground to make that kind of change happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was just thinking, as you said that, what a disservice it's probably a double-edged sword. What a disservice that the McCain-Palin did to us by erecting you as this boogeyman connected with Barack Obama. Because just what you said, I'm thinking, boy, I'd love to do a whole show on the future of education in this country. But going back to the campaign, why do you think that the Republican campaign wasted millions of dollars on ads about you when it seemed that what would have worked better for them was to continue with Reverend Jeremiah Wright? That seemed to resonate a lot more, particularly with white voters, certainly more than you. I think a lot of people were saying with Bill Ayers, Barack Obama, what the hell are they talking about? But the Reverend Wright thing could be used to scare people. They didn't go with that, though.
You know, I can't really get into their minds, and I don't know why they were doing any of the things they were doing, but my kids, two of whom are real political junkies, told me that none of those smears and fear campaign was working, and they speculated, my kids speculated, that it's because people are exhausted from the politics of it.
I'm sorry. Go over that again. You kind of bleeped out there for a second. Your kids said what?
My kids were saying, you know, that people are exhausted from the politics of fear.
Bill Ayers, one of the things that surprised a lot of people, and you spoke to this at the beginning, you said you didn't want to become a caricature as the way you were being presented by the McCain-Palin campaign, but some people thought you could have just put everyone's mind at rest by making a few simple statements and that you were essentially on the lam. Bill Ayers was in hiding, and that made the relationship between Obama and Ayers even more suspicious.
I never felt that I was in hiding or that I was being silent. I felt that I was teaching my classes, talking to my students, participating in the anti-war movement, all the things I do. But what I wasn't doing is I wasn't willing to respond to the kind of microphone thrust in my face with a dishonest question, which requires a two-minute soundbite. I didn't want to participate in the soundbite culture. I felt that I would be feeding the kind of giving oxygen to this kind of lie. And so I decided to just turn away. Whenever they thrust the microphone in my face, I turned away.
And they did.
And I found it difficult, frankly, to do that.
Yeah. And one of the things I thought the strangest accusation of all was that these conservatives had hired some, I don't know what you'd call it, someone who does analysis of writing, and they discovered through this analysis that Bill Ayers had actually written Barack Obama's books. Were you aware of that?
My kids sent me that. They thought that was hilarious, and I wrote them back and said, can I please get the royalties? I mean, my God, if I wrote it, I want the royalties. But, you know, it was a funny textual analysis. Some hyperventilating, paranoid person saw that there was apparently nautical imagery in my book and in Barack Obama's books and made the connection. But it was patently absurd on its face.
Well, one of the things, and a lot of the activities of the Weather Underground, in fact, that's what the book is all about, Fugitive Days, Memoirs of an Anti-War Activist by Bill Ayers, has a new afterword by the author. It's available, by the way, at beacon.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, is that you kept being pressed for an apology for your actions and the actions of the Weather Underground, where about two dozen facilities were bombed, that usually pretty small devices, still with the potential of hurting someone. They didn't, and yet you're pressed repeatedly when people speak to you, say, Bill Ayers, why won't you apologize for the acts of aggression against the United States or the acts of terror against the United States?
You know, my response is always the same, and it's that I feel, look, I'm 64 years old. You can't get this old without having lots of regrets, and I have personal regrets as well as political regrets, regrets for some of the time, some of the activities during some of the time that you and I knew each other 40 years ago. But what I don't regret is opposing a murderous war in Vietnam with every ounce of my strength. And the reality is that there was a terrible rain of violence. We were living in a sewer of violence. Thousands of people every month in Vietnam, innocent people, were being murdered by our government. And in the 10 years of that war, we couldn't figure out how to stop it. We did everything we could think of. We organized, we sat in, we counseled resistance, and still the war dragged on with no end in sight. When the anti-war movement reached a kind of crisis point in 1968. We convinced the majority to oppose the war, but the war went on and expanded. The anti-war movement splintered. Some people went into the Democratic Party and tried to organize a peace wing. Some people ran away to Europe and Africa, and we did what we did. I don't claim much for it. I don't even defend it, but I do try to write a book in which it's understood, it's understandable why that choice would be made. Not to defend it and say it was perfect, but to understand in those desperate times why desperate actions were taken.
Yeah, I think very few people realize that the United States Armed Forces were responsible for the deaths of 3 million civilians in Indochina.
That's right.
And,
that's right.
And that things like the Phoenix program assassinated under the aegis of the CIA, assassinated, I can't remember, 50,000 school teachers.
Between 50 and 100,000, that's
yeah.
Right.
And they want Bill Ayers to apologize for his group's putting a bomb in the offices of Anaconda Copper after the United States engineered a fascist coup in Chile.
Well, and I even understand the impulse to be horrified with what we were doing. I understand the impulse, but I think you're right. Any kind of measured analysis of the time, you know, would have to say that even though we were extreme, even though we committed extreme acts of vandalism against property, and even though we had a rhetoric of revolution that was a little bit off the tracks, comparing it to what else was going on and honestly accounting for it would involve me regretting large aspects of it, but it would also be measured against the government's actions and the regrets that they have to express. So it's that kind of imbalance that I find, you know, unpalatable, I guess.
Well, Bill Ayers, let's leave on a very positive note, because one thing I've known about you throughout your life is you're a positive person trying to make changes for the better, and certainly over the last 30 years or so, no one would disagree with the work you've done in education and race relations and other ways that try to make things good in this society. You have contact with, you have your own children, your grandfather, you counsel educators. What are the priorities? Where should we be going? We seem to have lost our way. Is there a beacon? That's a tough question.
And,
yeah.
Well, I think there is, and I think that what's exciting to me about the moment we're living through is that we just did something that was unthinkable just a couple of years ago. We elected this young, quite brilliant, quite hopeful African-American president. That was unthinkable. And in Grant Park, the night of the election, what was unthinkable felt to all of us like, wow, unforgettable and inevitable. And in this moment, it seems to me, we can reimagine a lot of the kind of things we've suffered under for the last couple of decades, and we can chart a new course. I want to do that in foreign policy. I want to stop thinking that the United States has to be the policeman of the world. I want to stop thinking that we're the only superpower. We must impose our will militarily. I want to think that we could be a nation among nations. I want to think economically that we could invest in people and invest in work. And I want to think that we could also invest in education and healthcare and starve some of the money from the military and from the caging industry and from surveillance. So those are the things that I think are on the table. What we need now, what we always need, is a great social movement that will put the new administration in a position where they can respond in the way they know they ought to, which is for people, against war, against injustice.
Well, Bill Ayers, thanks for taking the time on your drive from your speaking engagement. And engaged is probably the word that most describes your actions in the world. And it's a pleasure to know you. I'm proud to have palled around with you whenever we've had the opportunity, and I look forward to doing it in the future, and particularly to interviewing you and your companion Bernadine Dorn on your forthcoming book. So thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter. It's good to talk to you. I'll see you soon, I hope.
All right, we're back live on Night Call. Peter Werbe and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. Speaking about a ride, I think you could easily say if there was a criticism of it, I gave him a free ride, although I don't know, what more could I have sharply asked him?
Well, I'm sure there will be some phone calls asking you that.
Yeah, so if you'd like to comment, that was Bill Ayers, the man that Sarah Palin, boy, I can hardly remember their names. Sarah Palin
it's
and
only been
John
a few
McCain.
Weeks,
I know,
Peter.
But they seem like such, particularly McCain, ancient 20th century history.
Creatures of the past. Well, he's back on the Senate floor.
He is.
I saw that on the news.
And we actually have a story about Sarah Palin, which I'll get into. She is getting offers for hundreds and hundreds of speaking engagements.
Up the wazoo, as we say.
Something like that.
Many, many offers.
If you'd like to comment on that or anything else, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Short emails, please, to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. You can link onto that, and Bill Ayers' book, Fugitive Days, is on there as well. And also an advertisement. I don't know. An announcement. It's not really an advertisement. for our 1 a.m. interview, which will be with Lamar Waldron, who has authored the book A Legacy of Secrecy with Air America's Tom Hartman, which actually names the assassins of John F. Kennedy. This is a day after the 45th anniversary, and yes, there was a conspiracy indeed. And if you go down a little bit on the site, oh, yeah, it's Bruce Springsteen announces a new album. That's always good. But then there's a couple of pictures of Bill Ayers, and one is what his Good Morning America
appearance.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. How did I used to do this show alone?
I question that.
I would go, And there is an incredible documentary on the Weather Underground, the group that Ayers was part of in the 1970s, called The Weather Underground, and there's a link to that as well. I would highly recommend that film.
Is that something you need to rent, right? You can't.
I guess, yeah. Yeah, you can probably get it through Netflix or at your local.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, no, I saw it. That's how I kind of re-ran into Bill Ayers again about 5 or 6 years ago when he and Bernadine Dorn we're at a showing of it at Detroit Film Theater at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Okay, open lines for you at 313-298-WRIF. We'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Out there.
The pictures,
the podcast,
the blog,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall do just that.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
All right, let's see what's on my agenda today. I've got lunch with Dave.
Drops.
And then my afternoon business meeting.
Drops.
What about a happy hour?
Drops.
Listen to that little voice inside your head. Trump's is the place for lunch, happy hour, and entertainment that will be appreciated during any business meeting. Every day, their delicious burger and beer lunch is only $9.99. And every day, Trump's has lunch specials for under $10, including ribeye steaks. That's right, lunch for under $10 and Trump's entertainment. Plus, Tuesday is always all-you-can-eat crab legs day. Trump's has Detroit's best happy hour. All beers are just $4.25 and shots for just $3. So schedule your next happy hour meeting at Trump's and see why Trump's was voted Metro Detroit's best VIP room by Maxim Magazine.
Trump's on 8 Mile, just a half mile east of Telegraph. Home of the world's most beautiful women. Preview the fun at Trumps8Mile.com.
What's on your agenda?
Trump's.
On 8 Mile, just east of Telegraph, go to Trumps8Mile.com.
Do you work on your feet every day? Or maybe someone you love does? Well, if you do, then you know how important properly fitted and comfortable footwear is. And right now, you can save $20 on a pair of work boots at Red Wing Shoes in Livonia or Roseville. Get a pair of high-quality, properly fitted boots at Red Wing Shoes and save $20. Just find the ad here on WRIF.com. Print a copy and use it at Red Wing Shoes in Livonia or Roseville. Red Wing Shoes. Built to fit. Built to last.
This is Matt Demmer. Mercury's leasing, and we want to help you. For the hot new MKX, for the hottest crossover vehicles, Jack Emmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. Even honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. You can check out our vehicle inventory on the site, and you can bet that if you don't see what you're looking for, we can surely find it for you. Experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood and Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com. That's DEMMER.com.
Experience the Demmer difference. Right now at 2009 Lincoln MKS for $307 a month. And an AZ plan with Ford Lincoln Mercury. Dollars down plus tax. See dealer for details. Or check them out on the web at Demmer.com.
We're back. WRIF Detroit. Here's Kirby.
And gone in 60 seconds.
I think you really truly are struggling with that.
Yeah.
No, I'm not faking it.
I was kidding on that.
Okay.
One. Yeah. Tried to link to Barack Obama saying that Barack Obama had palled around with terrorists. If you heard it, I'd like to hear from you what you thought of the interview, whether how you thought he comported himself. I certainly gave him a free ride. But I don't know. I mean, I was trying to think, what would that monstrous Bill O'Reilly do? First off, he wouldn't have let him complete a sentence. And then he would have started yelling at him. So I don't think that would have worked. I'm trying to think, I don't know. I don't know what I could have asked him more aggressively. I mean, he really spoke, because that's what everyone's always pushing him on. You know, will you apologize? I think he should apologize right after Kissinger does.
Okay.
Yeah. Bill is responsible for zero deaths and some property damage. Henry Kissinger, among a lot of others, is responsible for the deaths of millions. So why in the world? I mean, John McCain palled around with terrorists, with Henry Kissinger. And the other thing, you know, we never really got into this about terrorism. There was never an attempt of Bill Ayers and the Weather Underground to invoke terror. They weren't trying to terrorize people. These were symbolic attacks on institutions they thought were undemocratically oppressing people around the world and here. They weren't trying to make citizens fearful. They weren't trying to hurt anyone. My opinion. Yours is good as well, and welcome. 313-298-WRIF. Let's take our first caller, who we don't have his name up, and I forget.
It's Craig from Brighton.
Okay. Yes, Craig, hi. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. You're on the air.
How are you tonight?
Good.
Good. Hey, I guess I would have asked him something about how he felt about his two friends, Terry and Ted, who died alongside of his girlfriend, Diane, in 1970 when they were assembling a nail bomb, and it went off prematurely and killed them. So, I mean, he is responsible for their deaths, I believe. And, you know, and I'm not trying to cast blame on him. I wasn't alive at that time.
Well,
I guess I would ask, how does he reflect on that now? Were those sacrifices worth it to him?
I don't think so. In fact, in other interviews, other people with sympathetic interviewers asked him that. And see, part of the problem is everyone, I don't even think, knows that history. But the Weather Underground began constructing at that time a segment of them, an anti-personnel bomb, as you said, a hideous decision. And that's what made them, there was a debate. If you read Bill Ayers' book, Fugitive Days, there was a debate within the group of what kind of bombing should take place. So they were going to plant a terrorist bomb, and there is some horrid justice to some extent, I guess, that it didn't harm other people, right? I mean, it's kind of sad to say, and I think if you know the book, that Ayers in many ways does feel responsible for that, and that's one of the things that he has to live with. But one asks, I mean, when are acts that you commit irredeemable? You know,
when they harm innocent people.
Yeah.
I think that's the point.
Well, I guess
The freedom, the First Amendment gives you the right to do anything you want until it harms somebody else, basically.
Well, I guess you could make the point that the three people of the Weather Underground that essentially killed themselves weren't innocent people,
sure.
Were they?
Yeah. Well, no, they were involved in acts of terrorism or trying to, and I guess that's how I would define it, today.
And I think that any acts of violence are worthy of condemnation. And
sure.
That it's a terrible tactic. It's unjustifiable, in any moral or ethical terms. It doesn't work as a political strategy or tactics.
Usually, it turns favors and attitudes against you.
Absolutely.
You resort to that, and we saw that.
So when
the freedom movement and everything else.
So the question is, when are people redeemed in a way? I mean, there's certain acts, like if somebody, for instance, murdered a child. That would be something that I would say would probably be irredeemable. If somebody killed somebody in a bar fight, that'd be a pretty horrible act, but there's probably a way that a person could work themselves back into society after serving a jail term. Is what Bill Ayers did when he was 18, 19, 20, 21 make him irredeemable for the good acts that he's done over the last 35 or 40 years with education?
Well, I think the fact that he's a free member of society today, displays the fact that he served you know, he paid his debt to society in whatever fashion he did.
Mm-hmm.
And society and the laws that govern our society allow him to be and to continue to be a better person than he was before. And I think, you know, he has to live with the ghosts of his past, and it probably makes him a better person today.
Yeah. And I just,
of what he has to live with, and that's something he'll never get over that. You know, I'm sure he probably has to deal with those skeletons all the time.
I suspect so. From his book, you can tell he was deeply in love with Diane Out, who died in it. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Any other opinions on all that? 313-298-WRIF.
We got an email from John in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. Thanks for the Ayers interview.
Well, that was then. I mean, the idea that, I mean, I don't know what to say. I didn't make my point fully during the interview. I talked about that McCain-Palin campaign raising Bill Ayers to the level of a campaign issue was so bad, so stupid on their part, and didn't work at all, fortunately.
Obviously not.
But then it actually gave Bill Ayers some prominence, and the kind of work he's done around education, and our educational system is in such bad shape.
Oh, yeah.
Such terrible shape.
In shambles. Kathy from Green Bay wrote, Peter and Julian, I particularly liked Ayers' use of the word vandalism, which is what they meant to and did do. Yeah. Vandalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there is some forgiving. Apparently, the Vatican has finally forgiven John Lennon for declaring that the Beatles were more famous than Jesus Christ, calling the remark a boast by a young man grappling with sudden fame. And let's see here. The Vatican Daily said the remark by John Lennon, which triggered deep indignation, mainly in the United States, after many years, sounds like only a boast by a young working-class Englishman faced with unexpected success after growing up in the legend of Elvis and rock and roll. The article marking the 40th anniversary of the Beatles' The White Album went on to praise the pop band. Lennon was murdered, of course, almost 40 years ago. Was that right? 30 years ago. Now, here's... Yeah, I never heard his full statement. He didn't say, let me see, what did they say? He said that they were, where is this here? That they were more famous. That's not what he said. Here's what he said. In 1966, I mean, can you believe this stuff just keeps coming around? You
know,
like,
no.
Like in, I'm trying to think, like in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s, nobody was talking about what people were saying in the 20s.
That's a good point.
Yeah. On March 4th, 1966, this quote of John's was printed in an interview by a reporter, Maureen Cleave, in the London Evening Standard. And here's what John Lennon said. Christianity will go. It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue with that. I'm right, and I will be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now. That's what he said. We're more popular than Jesus.
Mm.
I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity. Jesus was all right, but his disciples were thick and ordinary. He means, you know, is the modern manifestations of him. It's them twisting it that ruins it for me, said John. He was, as she reported, reading extensively about religion at the time. No one took notice of it in Britain. And then 5 months later, on July 29th, a teen magazine in the U.S. Called Datebook reprinted the quote out of context instead of submerging it in an article and used it as part of a front cover story. Radio stations in the South banned Beatles music. There were rallies of boys and girls stomping on their records and bonfires of Beatles material. John received death threats, and the KKK protested a Beatles concert in Alabama.
It's always the South.
That's what I don't like about the South.
Oh, for real. You know, on that note, Peter, on the whole religion note, you got an email from Tony who said he's a very religious person and wanted to know where you stand and what your view on the silencing and dissection of God in the 50 year.
Don't know, Tony. Okay. Rewrite it.
Separation of church. Well, he's keeping it brief for you because you asked him to.
All right. Give me a few more words.
Separation of church and state, and also your take on abortion and homosexuality. I think you can lay it on the line real quick.
Yeah.
Church and state, keep it separate.
Yeah, got it.
Abortion, don't have one if you don't like it.
Right.
And homosexuality, who cares?
Yeah. Ain't nobody's business.
If I could be so bold as to answer for you.
Yeah, it's okay. There's a song from the 20s called Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do. Yeah, so people should mind their own business and take care of their own business instead of trying to take care of other people's business. Now, here's what John said a little later on. He had Did he apologize? Here's what John said. If I had said television is more popular than Jesus, I might have gotten away with it. But I just happened to be talking to a friend and used the word Beatles as a remote thing, not as I think as Beatles, as those other Beatles, like other people see us. That sounds like Sarah Palin.
I'm not following.
Yeah. I just said they are having more influence on kids, the Beatles, and things than anything else, including Jesus. But I said it in that way, which was the wrong way. Reporter, some teenagers have repeated your statements. I like the Beatles more than Jesus Christ. What do you think about that? Well, originally I pointed out that fact in reference to England, that we meant more to kids than Jesus did, or religion at that time. I wasn't knocking it or putting it down. I was just saying it as a fact, and it's true, more for England than here in the United States. I'm not saying that we're better or greater or comparing us with Jesus Christ as a person or God as a thing or whatever it is. I just said what I said, and it was wrong, or it was taken wrong, and now it's all this. Got him to be a big flap.
Yeah.
Now, here's a big flap. Obama has not been going to church.
That bad boy.
Bad boy, yeah. And I'll answer Tony's question a little more. According to Politico, President-elect Barack Obama has yet to attend church services since winning the White House earlier this month, a departure from the example of his two immediate predecessors. Yeah, now, you can tell what fine, moral, ethical, upstanding men George W. Bush and old dog Bill Clinton was. They went to church every single Sunday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever.
On the three Sundays since his election, Obama has instead used his free time to get in workouts at a Chicago gym. Yeah. But, Tony?
Well, we need to keep the man healthy.
Yeah, we do. We got him.
He can pray, Tony, in his bedroom there, you know.
I read this so frequently. Here's Article 6. Pardon me, of the United States Constitution, the senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislatures and all the executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, which includes the president, shall be bound by oath or affirmation, which means you do not have to swear on a Bible, to support this Constitution. And it adds, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Get it?
Yeah, but it seems as though it's the opposite.
Yeah, yeah. And where's that old thing that nobody knows anything about? Oh, yeah, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. So, that religion has no place in government. Oh, yeah, what's this other big thing? The economy.
Yeah, in fact, you got an email from Roderick who said he can't call in. But could you cover the economy, property tax increases, and food shortages, etc.? I think we have other things ahead of those right now.
Property tax increases?
That's what he said. I don't know what he's talking about.
Just the value of all our homes, of those of us who are homeowners, are going down. Aren't we going to have to pay less?
I don't know. I don't know what he's getting at.
Yeah, I don't
Roderick,
know what he's
right
getting.
Back.
Yeah, everybody's got to write clearer. Mitt Romney, the son of George Romney, who was the president of the old American Motors, wrote a piece in the New York Times called Let Detroit Go Bankrupt. That was his little...
Nice little headline.
Nice little headline, yeah.
We really appreciate it here in Detroit.
Yeah, and God, his dad must be rolling in his grave. I wonder what he would have said if he would have been the presidential campaign or the presidential candidate on the Republican Party.
Yeah, true.
I doubt that. Right. The Center for Automotive Research reports that if one of the big three ceased operations in 2009, nearly 2.5 million jobs would be lost in the first year. And let me tell you, folks, this then would really make this 1929 or into 1930. And if 2.5 million jobs are lost, then that would spiral down so much that we would have a depression that would make the 1930s look like a recession. This is really frightening. 1 year of bankruptcy would result in the loss of $125 billion in personal income, $17 billion in Social Security receipts, and $20 billion in personal income taxes lost. So what to do? Certainly, the big three presidents that showed up in Washington this week on their private jets.
Yeah, three private jets.
Yeah,
I mean, thought they could at least get together on this.
And don't you think they could have driven their hybrids?
Right.
I mean, who's doing their PR?
I know they're making them.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons, that, and Mitt Romney certainly doesn't mention this, that the important reason the American automakers cannot compete with the foreign ones is that BMW, Honda, Nissan, and Toyota are all in countries that have universal health care. So our companies here in Detroit have to pick up the health care, not only for the active workers, but also for all the retirees. I said this last week. I never could understand why they weren't the biggest promoters of the government picking up the tab for health care. Doesn't make a bit of sense. Also, everybody's saying, you know, they made the wrong car. You know, they made these SUVs.
Oh, yeah, and then there was another, I don't know, I was watching one of these news programs talking about the quality. It's their fault because their quality isn't as good, you know, the American cars.
I don't know what to say about that. How are they rated? I think, like, Toyota's really usually rated at the top.
Yeah.
But I don't think the American cars are rated too badly,
are
they?
I think they've come a long way.
Sure. But one of the things that became clear to auto executives and all their boards and their investors is they had to make these big behemoths in order to make profit. In other words, if they made very small cars, the profit margin was a lot smaller. And if they were paying all this money for pensions and for health care, they were almost forced to try to push the largest cars imaginable.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The best recommendation for the bailouts that I've heard is that the oil companies ought to do the bailouts. They've got the money,
uh-huh.
and they're the ones with these low mileage cars that the big companies were putting out that made them able to reap these obscene profits.
Yeah, yeah.
That would make some sense.
Bring it on.
I thought that, you know, I actually saw a letter in the New York Times I thought was interesting. It says, missing from both Detroit pleas for a bailout and national discussion of the pros and cons is any acknowledgement that the American taxpayer continuously subsidizes the auto industry through the financing of local, state, and federal roads.
Ah.
I mean, it says, if car companies were suddenly forced to acquire the land and maintain the infrastructure that its products need to function, the real cost of a car would be beyond the reach of all but the wealthiest people, and our national economy would come to a standstill. Whether General Motors is too big to fail and therefore deserves a bailout ignores the fact that the company, along with every other car maker in the world, is subsidized by tax dollars. You could say that historically, that one of the functions of government was to provide roads, byways and highways and what have you. But certainly the amount of investment in infrastructure that we pay for, and we say, well, we want to drive our cars in it. I mean, it's sort of circular, but we ought to understand that none of this is cost-free. Although I did notice coming in that gasoline was $1.69
yeah.
at Citgo.
Go get it now. It's probably going to go up for the holidays.
Yeah, it will. Let's see. Here's Jeff in Oxford. Jeff, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. The reason why I was calling for tonight, by the way, long-time listener, regularly.
Thank you.
Was in regards to the email that I had sent out with the property taxes being frozen with the proposal that's being put in place up in Lansing at the rate of where they're at 2007 and 2008. The reason it's kind of important to bring up, or at least to make people aware of, is that the value of the houses are continually going down. The bubble has burst, and what happens is you're still paying property taxes of what your house was at its peak prime level.
Sure.
So you got a house that you're paying taxes on, hypothetically, let's say $3,000-$4,000 a year. But the value of your house is going way down below $100,000, let's say. So, I mean, I can talk from personal experience. I was lucky enough to sell my home August of this year.
Well, and, congratulations.
I was on the market for at least 2.5 years.
Mm.
And it's a higher-end home, and they're just not selling. Like I said, I was very fortunate. But I was paying quite a bit on property taxes. And the value was going down.
Well, let me run this by you, Jeff. I was thinking about this, and a neighbor spoke to me and said, well, don't you think we ought to go ask for a reassessment of our taxes? Because, obviously, our value of our property may have dropped by as much as a third.
Yeah, remember we got those things. Peter and I live in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
We got those cards with the values of our homes. It was frightening.
Well, here's the deal. If, say, we could do that. isn't that going to really hurt the cities that we live in? Because they're way even before this crash began, most of the municipalities were hurting for tax revenue. I mean, the whole state's in bad shape. If we all of a sudden start saying, let's pay a lot less, we're going to be hurting. We may be cutting off our nose to spite our face.
Absolutely. I agree with what you're saying, and that would be the case. But here's the kicker. Another thing that was also kind of rolled in at the tail end of this this proposal was that you can't attest the value of your property. Meaning you can't go in front of a board and fight that, saying, "Hey, look, you know."
Right. Sure, you can. Of course, you can.
Well, you can, but my neighbor across the street on my old subdivision of the house that I sold went in to fight the fact that his property taxes went up quite a bit within less than a year, greater than that percentage that's, allocated. Well, they laughed at him. They said, "Hey, look, you live in a nice big house. You can afford it." And, they pretty much shuffled him out of the...
I don't know what recourse you have, but I've been living in my house for quite a while, and my taxes are about half of what Jalene's are. And... So
we're about six blocks apart.
Yeah. And well, it's just because of that Headley Amendment. They can't keep raising my taxes except for, small percentage. Whereas when you move in, you get the full, you have to pay the full boat at the current tax. So I guess I pretty much decided that I am not going to appeal it. I suppose if somebody was living in a house, one of those things where the mortgage is upside down and it's owe more than it's worth, I guess that would make some sense. But we do have to understand that when you start looking at like the state of California going bankrupt, when the city of Detroit is tens of millions of dollars in debt, we got to really think about this. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for bringing that up. Open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. And Peter Roderick wrote back about what he meant and said, due to the fact that less money is coming in through taxes, supposedly property taxes are increasing in many areas of the country in an attempt to make up for the losses. That's what he was saying.
All right. On my website, peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, I called for George W. Bush to resign and let the Democrats take power immediately. And I do that kind of thing to be very provocative and very radical. Well, it's hitting the mainstream.
It always does eventually. It usually takes a few years.
But this was just a couple of weeks. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan will be right back to get your calls.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
All right, $9 million.
All of you who have stuck with me.
Divided by 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIM. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
Change. Yeah, I like that about as much as I like going to the opera. But you know how it is. You move to a new city and you need to find a place to live, a new favorite sports bar, and eventually, a new dentist. I'm Tim Wilson, and I thought I had the best of the best in Chicago. Then I met Dr. Dan Moroff. I'd heard Cherry Hill Dental Center's ads on Risk Mike in the morning and thought about calling. Then I heard the ad again and picked up the phone. I got an appointment with Dr. Dan right away. From the plasma TV in the waiting room to the state-of-the-art equipment, I liked what I saw. I've even been back for more, and I've got a great new smile. Motor City, Dr. Dan's the best. Now, here's the man himself.
Thanks, Tim. At Cherry Hill Dental Center, we take the same expert care with all of our patients, whether you want Zoom whitening, veneers, crowns, or a cleaning and an exam.
I've had all those done.
Give me a call at Cherry Hill Dental Center, 734-427-2880. That's 734-427-2880. Or visit cherryhilldental.com. Get the smile, get the confidence. At Cherry Hill Dental Center, we'll help you get it all.
What's a Walyu?
It's the perfect gift for the holidays.
But what is a Walyu?
Your kid will love it.
So what is a Walyu?
Walyu is a life-size vinyl graphic that sticks to any surface. So, you can show off your little leaguer just like the pros. It looks great in the bedroom, basement, garage, or anywhere you want to decorate. And it's not just for kids. Get a Wall U of your motorcycle or your sports car or boat. For anything you want to show off, it's a Wall U. So check it out now at www.wall-theletteru.com. That's wall-theletteru.com. Wall U, the perfect gift.
What's a Wall U?
It's the perfect gift for the holidays.
But what is a Wall U?
Your kid will love it.
So what is a Wall U?
All right, we've been over this before, but it does bear repeating. A Wall U is a life-size vinyl graphic that sticks to any surface. Imagine the possibilities. Whatever you have that you want to show off, it's a Wall U. Look for the Wall U ad on WRIF.com.
101.1 WRIF, WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. My co-host, Jalene Jordan, with me. In the first hour at 11 o'clock, if you missed it, I interviewed Bill Ayers, the man who the McCain-Palin campaign was accusing Barack Obama of palling around with. Didn't help him a bit. In fact, Bill Ayers, on another interview I heard, said every time they mentioned his name, they dropped a percentage point in popularity.
Oh, my.
People just don't want to hear that.
He's going to sell a lot of books, too, because of all of that. So they only helped this friend of yours.
Yep. I palled around with him, indeed. Fugitive Days, the name of Bill Ayers' book. You can go to my website or just Google Bill Ayers, A-Y-E-R-S. I think he has BillAyers.com. And let's see, 1 a.m. Eastern Time, Lamar Waldron has authored the book Legacy of Secrecy, and he's co-authored it with Air America's Tom Hartman, names the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and why Kennedy was killed, as it says here on my website. Yes, there was a conspiracy. I don't think there's too many people. It's so odd. I mean, the official historical designation is that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Right? Mm-hmm. And I think something like only 20% of people in America believe
that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something else on here.
Well, while you're looking.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Go ahead.
You got an email from Steph, who generally disagrees with 99% of your beliefs, Peter, but she listens as much as possible.
Thank you, Steph.
Yeah. Anyway, she says, I always struggle with the separation of churches. Church and state issue when reading some of the older statements made by our earlier presidents. Example, read George Washington's Thanksgiving proclamation, October 14, 1789. He speaks explicitly about our government and its relation to God. And she says she's not trying to prove anything, just trying to point out that it's an issue that more than the left wants to believe.
Okay. Well, here's what it says on my website. We are so not over Bush because Bush is so not over. And then on my website it says, Bush and Cheney resign now. And then I wrote underneath it, maybe this isn't so crazy after all, because in today's New York Times, is it still, it's yesterday's by 19 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Gail Collins says, Thanksgiving is next week and President Bush could make it a really special holiday by resigning. Seriously, she says, we have an economy that's crashing in a vacuum at the top. Bush, who currently is on a trip to Peru to meet with Asian leaders who no longer care what he thinks, hasn't got the clout or possibly even the energy to do anything useful. His most recent contribution to resolving the fiscal crisis was lecturing representatives of the world's most important economies on the glories of free market capitalism. Well, that's really worked out well, hasn't it? Gail Collins says, putting Barack Obama in charge immediately isn't impossible. Dick Cheney, obviously, would have to quit as well as Bush. In fact, just to be on the safe side, the vice president ought to turn in his resignation first.
Yeah.
And she says, we're desperate, but not crazy. Then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi would become president until January 20th. Obviously, she'd defer to her party's incoming chief executive, and Barack Obama could begin governing. And she says, can I see a show of hands? How many people want George W. out and Barack in?
Raising my hand.
Let's see. But she also says, in happier days, Bush may have nurtured hopes of making it into the list of America's mediocre presidents. But somewhere between Iraq and Katrina, that goal became a mountain too high. However, he might still have a chance to avoid the absolute bottom of the barrel, a spot currently occupied by James Buchanan. Buchanan nailed down the worst president title in the days between Abraham Lincoln's election and inauguration, when the southern states began seceding, and Buchanan, after a little flailing about, did absolutely nothing. And historian Michael Beschloss says, doing nothing is almost the worst thing a president can do. And, well, in this case, George Bush is not just a zero, he's less than zero, because he is involved in writing any number of executive orders and pushing through all these other orders that would cripple more of the environment, hurt workers more, a hundred different things that he's trying to get in that is a right-wing corporate wish list. For instance, the Bush administration, let's see, where was this? This was in commondreams.org. The Bush administration finalized regulations to govern the commercial development of oil shale on federal lands on Monday, rebuffing concerns that the rules are premature and ignoring the serious environmental concerns about tapping the resource. Actually, that the commercial technology to tap the resource and make it economically feasible doesn't even exist and could be a decade away from reality. And then the article says that's one reason the decision to issue the rules has irked environmentalists and some Democratic lawmakers who worry about the massive outlays of water and energy needed to convert compounds and sedimentary rocks into synthetic crude oil. The oil shale has been labeled the dirtiest fuel on the planet by the Natural Resources Defense Council, which estimates that production will emit four times more greenhouse gases than conventional gasoline production. So here is Bush, talk about rooted in the 20th century and not into the 21st century, that they're still trying to eke out an oil economy.
Yeah, they sure are.
Yeah. All of this poisonous resource, they're not willing to give up on it. They're not willing to create what was it called for the atomic bomb? The Manhattan Project. Get us off of fossil fuels so that the environmental damage and the wars that we fight for all of this would be a thing of the 20th century. This man is so dangerous and so terrible.
And not with those of us who are working toward this whole green movement.
Yeah. The New York Times on Sunday said, the price of our good name, just more about Bush because we're not over him. Americans have watched in horror as President Bush has trampled on the Bill of Rights and the balance of power. The list of abuses that President-elect Barack Obama must address is long. Once again, require the government to get warrants to eavesdrop on Americans, undo scores of executive orders and bill signing statements that have undermined the powers of Congress, strip out the unnecessary invasions of privacy embedded in the Patriot Act, block new FBI investigative guidelines straight out of J. Edgar Hoover's playbook. On and on and on. Those are not the only disasters Mr. Obama will inherit. He'll also have to rescue a drowning economy, restore regulatory sanity to the financial markets, and extricate the country from an unnecessary war in Iraq.
Well, good luck.
Yeah. The audacity of hope. Are you going to the inauguration?
I'm not going.
Did we talk about this? Well, I'm having deja vu all over again with this.
You know, I went to the counter inauguration.
In 2004.
Yeah, which was so great, I have to say. I don't know if anything could top it.
Well, how about this? There's supposed to be 5 million people there.
Well, there's a reason not to go.
I know, because
we're being represented, it sounds like.
Yeah, they were. I think the biggest one before that was 500,000 people in 1964. And the city of Washington has just said, be prepared for gridlock.
Yeah, I can't handle that.
I don't know if I can either. But a lot of people are going. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Let's see, here's Joel in Royal Oak. Joel, hi, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, I haven't heard you guys mention it. I heard you mention Dick Cheney earlier, and have you heard that him and Alberto Gonzalez, as well as some other people, have been indicted?
Well, not for the crimes that they richly deserve to be indicted for.
I agree with you on that, but it's a start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a start.
Yeah, he was indicted. There was, boy, I can't even remember all the details, but because of his, because of Cheney's involvement of investments in this prison firm, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And where, somebody, was murdered, and they're trying to tie into that too.
Yeah.
They were murdered in the prison.
Well, I'll tell you, I think the indictment is pretty weak because we have all these, things that Bush and Cheney could be indicted for, both under American law and under international law. So.
Sure.
Anything would be good, though. Any kind of punishment.
Absolutely. And, hopefully, one last thing, hopefully, Bush and Karl Rove are next.
Hopefully.
Yes.
All right. Thank you,
we
Joel.
We hear you, Joel.
313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Wally. Wally's in Sterling Heights. Hi, Wally.
Hi, folks.
Hi.
First, a point and a question. Bush was bred to be a bad president. Do you realize that his mom's maiden name is Pierce?
You know, you're on a cell phone.
It's Pierce.
Pierce, yeah.
Franklin Pierce.
Yeah?
Yeah, he was the only president not recommended to run for a second term by his own party.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. He had
now funny.
I got it. Now I got it, yeah.
That's his mom's great-uncle.
How about
really?
This, though? George W. Bush lost the popular vote in 2000. People didn't want him.
Yeah,
and we wound up with this guy.
Now, question.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Here we go, he said.
Oh.
Yeah. Women can vote. The children of ex-slaves can vote. Monarchs are nothing more than a, sort of an oddity now.
Monarchs are, yeah.
We can pretty much go to bed with anybody we like. Soon, I believe that soon you'll be able to marry anybody.
I hope so.
So my question is to you, don't liberal ideas more often than not win in the end?
Yes,
Not without struggle.
Yeah.
I'm just asking.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And Howard Zinn, the great historian, a great American historian, said, we lose every battle, but we win the war. Yeah, so that's well said.
Yeah.
Thank you, Wally. Appreciate it.
Wally, you just gave me a glimmer of hope.
This was good. You know, out in California, there was Proposition 8, and that would remove the right of same-sex marriage.
Yes.
Yeah. It was declared unconstitutional by, the law was declared unconstitutional by the California State Supreme Court. And then it was upheld by the voters, essentially. They voted.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, it turns out that the man who ran all these false ads about Proposition 8 has a sister who's a lesbian.
Yes, he does.
And he says,
does
though,
he know it?
Well, unless he learned about it in this article. But wait a minute here. It was something where it said that he...
This is for his part. Mr. Schubert said he is neither anti-gay.
Right.
That's how they always say it. My sister's a lesbian. I'm not anti-gay. Well, you kind of are.
Where is the thing about... are we reading the same article?
We are.
Yeah.
We are.
How come? But he said he's not anti-gay, right?
Right. It says, for his part, Mr. Schubert says he is neither anti-gay, his sister is a lesbian, nor happy that some same-sex couple marriages are now in question. Well, why did he start this thing?
Right.
He has no regrets about the campaign.
And then we turn, of course, to the murder of a transgender woman in Memphis. And I don't want to go into all the details of this, but words have consequences. And when you designate a group of people as being unfit to be part of the community, well, then they lose a lot of their protection that people that one has as a human being.
Yeah.
In other words, 99% of us don't need laws against murder, right?
Right.
Yeah, none of us are going to go out and murder people. If someone said, okay, you can murder anybody you want, maybe 1% of the psychos that are around would do it. But what it creates is social permission to hurt people, to discriminate against them at maybe the nicest thing you can do to the worst thing you can do. And think about that. That's the nicest thing you can do. Discriminate against love. I don't even know why that this is anything to do with the law. What churches ought to decide who they want to marry. Like you can say, you know, do they still say that in the Catholic Church? You can only marry Catholics, all right?
I believe so.
I think you're Orthodox Jews. You can only marry Orthodox Jews or Muslims. You can only marry Muslims and all that. Who cares? If somebody wants to get wrapped up in that stuff, that's their beeswax. I don't care. I don't understand why they do, but it's up to them. But the marriage, you know, you hear this phrase, the marriage contract. Like, if you go and you, like, I went and registered at City Hall.
Yeah, I did it twice.
Right. Right. So you have a civil contract that marries you, and the hell with the religious stuff, unless you want. If you're a heterosexual couple and you want to have a religious marriage, go ahead. If you don't, a lot of people don't. They go down to City Hall and they get married. I don't even know why this is a legal issue, particularly since the Constitution forbids this kind of insertion of religiosity into the body political, right?
Yes. The last time I got married, I had a...
Was this the one you were sober or not sober?
I don't think I was in any of them.
Okay.
But, no, when I decided that we needed to renew the vows because I got married... I got married in Vegas, and this woman gave us this religious ceremony, which I didn't want, but here it was. So we go to Jamaica. We're going to renew our vows at this little resort. And I say, no, I want a judge. I do not want a priest. I don't want anything. All of a sudden, here comes this Jamaican priest. And I told my now ex-husband, we're still not married.
And did he? This was a Jamaican priest, and did he have a big,
spliff?
Spliff. Yeah. Big spliff.
He didn't, although his eyes were kind of red.
All right. Here's Eric in Waterford. Eric, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I got a question and a comment for all those people out there commenting about the auto industry and the fact that GM and Ford and Chrysler are going belly up. It all ties down to UAW. I mean, these guys make $30, $40, $50+ an hour. I work in aviation, and I make $20 an hour. And, you know, these people sit here, and they bitch, and they groan about the fact that they're not making enough money. I'm barely scraping sides, and I'm not complaining because of the fact that I have a job.
Well, I'll tell you what, Eric. Trying to make the unions a scapegoat. I know a lot of people that work in auto. I know a lot of people that even work for the UAW. In fact, Jolene and I once worked for the UAW.
We did.
In their radio department. And then no one's making $50 an hour. But whatever. What happened is that unions fought for their members to make a middle class wage, and they were able to afford it. It's the mismanagement of the companies. If they can knock down union wages, they can knock down yours. They'll first go after the union people because that's where they're organized, they're strong. I mean, they're a shadow of their old self, but comparative to a worker all by his or herself, they're relatively strong. So if you can knock down union workers to 20, pal, I got to tell you, you'll be making 10 soon.
You know, I am non-union, and I make 48, 50 grand a year. And these union workers get their pensions and this and that, and I still get my 401k. I work for a prestigious aviation company in Waterford, and these people just, the unions are outdated.
Well, wait a minute. Why do you say these people? These are your neighbors. These are the people that do everything from police and fire to the Detroit Symphony Orchestra to radio announcers. And why shouldn't people organize to raise their standard of living? Let me go over this one more time that you completely ignored, Eric. If they can knock down union wages, Eric from Waterford is going to be making $10 an hour. They're going to start with the unions, and they're coming after you next.
No, but you don't understand where I'm going. I'm talking about automotive unions.
I understand that. Fine. I'm saying that, there's only one cost in manufacturing that is variable, and that is labor, the price of labor, the selling price of labor. And in periods of contraction like this, there's always an attempt to make up for the mistakes that these rich guys in suits screwed up the entire system. They're still taking their bonuses, and they're still living high on the hog. Go get a copy of the New York Times, the Sunday and take a look at the ads for $675 shoes and $1,000 handbags and the rest of it. They're living just fine, and what they want people, the average working person, and if you don't see some solidarity with them, and if you don't see the reason that you're making $20 is because of the struggle of unions over the last 50 years, or really 150 years, you're really short-sighted, I got to tell you. All right, thanks for calling. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jesse's in Holly. Hi, Jesse. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi. I had just, like, you know, some questions and comments about, like, you know, the gay marriage thing.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like, I was talking to my parents, and, like, you know, they're very straight-edge religious and everything, but at the same time, they're all for, like, you know, they're very political, and they're for rights and everything, and we butt heads all the time because, you know, I was talking to them about gay marriage and the fact that it's not the fact that it's a gay marriage, it's the fact that there's rights being taken away. But they totally ignore that fact and just focus on, like, you know, the homosexual part because they're 100% against it. But, and, like, I feel like it's a double-edged sword.
Wow. How old are you?
I am 18.
Wow. I don't know, for some reason you sounded younger than that, but you know what I have to say to you is don't give up, and it's, I think it's great that you are butting heads, you know, for it. I don't want you to get in fights with your parents. But
I was going to say the opposite. Leave it alone.
No. Okay. I think that maybe that you can create change in your own family. You never know. I have a family of entirely Republicans, but I have to tell you that's one thing that they don't care who gets married. So you never know what you...
Yeah, my parents are, like, diehard Republicans, so...
Yeah, it's kind of hard when you're a little bit different than the rest of the family, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Jesse, though, I never could understand... I mean, if someone has a religious objection to it, I can kind of understand that, and then they should only marry people of the opposite sex, and maybe they would even, in within their church, say, we will only marry people that adhere to a certain standard. But as I said earlier, that people should have the legal right to make a contract that binds them together because there's so many important aspects.
Well, I think it's more the insurance thing, you know.
Property, end-of-life considerations.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things, Jesse, that we have never gotten out of anyone on this show is how gay marriage harms traditional marriage. And, like, I've been married to a woman for a long, long time, and I don't feel threatened. And you know, when you see gay people's marriage, when they, I don't know if you've ever seen, you ever seen, like, videos of it on television or on the news?
Oh, yes, you have.
Yeah, they are so happy. They are so ecstatic, and it is beyond...
Happier than straight couples.
Yeah, well, the reason they're happier, they're saying, hey, we just got recognized as a full human beings with full rights in this society.
Yeah. And so that's a great point, Peter, and that maybe Jesse could kind of hone in on if they continue to bring that up. Say, why do you think these people are less than human?
Yeah.
Because that's not really... That's not very Christian.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, the thing is, it's not the fact that, we're gay and everything. It's the fact that there's a right being taken away. We don't get to call ourselves, like, you know, a couple. We have to call each other domestic partners. Or, you know, like, we can't even profess our marriage. We have to say, oh, we are domestic partners. She's my life partner. We can't say, oh, this is my lovely wife.
Well, you know, right. Jesse, there's been all sorts of restrictions throughout history on who could marry. Up till 1967, states in the United States had laws forbidding black people and white people to marry. And there were in Germany that Jews could not marry Gentiles. And during slavery, blacks couldn't marry at all. They weren't allowed to. And times change, and we're at a period where people shouldn't be forced into thinking, okay, maybe in another 10 or 20 or 30 years, people just don't deserve that kind of humiliation. All right, Jesse, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye. 313-298-WRIF.
Don't give up.
Here's Matt in Canton. Hi, Matt. Peter and Jolene, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Julian. How you doing? I love the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I try to catch it whenever I can. It's on Sunday nights at midnight.
Yeah, 11 o'clock. And you know what? You can also listen to, we have podcasts that are at Peter's website, peterwerby.com, or WRIF.com. They are usually up by noon on Mondays. So
today,
if you ever miss the show, you can listen to the podcast at your leisure.
Yeah, and I should tell people that I did an interview with Bill Ayers at 11 o'clock. Bill Ayers, if you missed it, you can hear that on the podcast. Go ahead, though. You're on the air.
Okay. I was about the UAW. I agree with you, what you're saying. The union has, they fought hard and they've gotten what they've got. But over time, the foreign competition is what's shutting them out. And with everybody else losing jobs and wages being cut back, any of the blue collar trades, they're all being cut back. People can't afford to go out and buy a brand new Taurus for $40,000. And I think the biggest cut should come on the hands of the executives and the white collars. I don't understand how they can run a company if they have to slash 4,000 white collar jobs.
Sure.
What were all those people doing in the first place?
Well, that's interesting.
Go ahead. I just don't, when people are forced, if you got average Joe Blow that works at McDonald's, he makes 25 grand a year and that's the best he's going to do. He needs a new car for his wife and newborn. He's got to buy a Kia. He doesn't have a choice. He can't buy American.
Yeah.
And there needs to be concessions on both sides between the UAW and the executives. And the UAW's already given up a lot with the two-tier wage system that they just brought in.
The UAW has given up, surrendered so much, so many concessions, way beyond what I would have ever voted for. And
said no more, though, right?
Well, they always say no more, and then UAW president Gettelfinger, Ron Gettelfinger, just said, "Well, we're willing to be flexible." But so all this flexibility, all these givebacks, all these two-tier wage systems, they ought to have something in there that if I hate to say it like this, but if things return to good times, is that the UAW workers that gave up all of this, that created the wealth of these companies, created the wealth of these companies, that they'll get paid back for the concessions they made. But I don't think that's on their agenda. All right, thank you very much. Hey, some of you righties that were concerned that Barack Obama was going to be this Marxist socialist, apparently, this headline, Obama tilts to center.
Tilts. He was already there.
Yeah, I know. That's what is. In fact, I think if he tilted toward the center, that means he'd be going to the left.
Yeah, right.
And certainly nobody that he has mentioned is putting into his cabinet and his advisors are anything but mainstream, and maybe even to the right of that. How do you say his name? Geithner. Will be the Secretary of Treasury and, a former colleague at the Treasury Department said he's no liberal. On the other hand, Barack Obama says that he is going to take swift action on vast economic stimulus plan, is that he's going to create 2.5 million jobs, and he said it would be a plan big enough to meet the challenge we face, that he hoped to sign the stimulus package into law after taking office on January 20th, like almost immediately.
Yeah.
That's why we got to clear the decks, get Bush and Cheney out of there now. Can we really wait another 2 months?
Well, we really can't, but it looks, reality, we're going to have to.
On the other hand, remember that he was always talking about he was going to increase the taxes of the ultra wealthy?
Oh, he's decided he's going to hold off on those rollbacks.
See, we can't just depend on him. That's why there's got to be a mass movement of us's to say that, come on. And what would happen? They're going to allow it to expire on 2010. And some Republicans might be won over should Mr. Obama decide not to repeal the Bush tax cuts for those making over $250,000 by simply letting the cuts expire after 2010. So, he could say, well, that's political reality. If you want the Republicans on board and you want to really get things moving, the Republicans are going to defend the tax structure of the ultra wealthy, the hell with the middle class and the working class.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Let's take some calls. 313-298-WRIF. That's our phone number here. This is Jerry. Jerry's in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, Peter. Hey, Jolene.
Hey.
I just want to comment real quick about that caller earlier who called about the unions. I think you should understand that in this country, the wealthy are allowed to pool their resources, which is capital, in the form of corporations, and say that these corporations, under the law, have the same rights. These virtual entities have the same rights as individuals, but yet when workers, laborers, pool their resources in the form of unions, they say that this is a bad thing.
Sure.
You know, this isn't socialism or redistribution of the wealth. This is simply a leveling of the playing field. And if we don't allow this to happen, these corporations will, and the wealthy will just run right over us. That's really the issue here.
Yeah, that's what they're using this as. They want to destroy unions. That's part of the Bush and Republican goal, is to diminish the power of unions, which, of course, would also diminish the power of the Democratic Party. But wait a minute. Let's be clear, though, Jerry, about redistribution of wealth. Everything is always about distribution of wealth. I used this example a little while ago, another show. I said, if I go to my boss and say, I want $5 a week more, and he said, ah, you know, it's nothing. Okay, sure, you got another $5 a week, not even an hour, a week. That is a redistribution of wealth. The company has $5 less, I have $5 more. If wages were left to vagaries of the market, the tender mercies, if we were at the tender mercy of the free market, we all would be making about $3 an hour. One of the things that unions do is they artificially raise the selling price of labor. The selling price of labor is what we get paid, in our hourly or our salary or whatever. And so it's important that we don't allow the so-called free market to exercise power over our wages, because that's the only thing that has the free market, because the markets are controlled by corporations and through assistance by the government. But they always want to say, let the market determine what we should be paid. Well, I say, I'll be making $3 an hour.
Well, I further believe that it's a not only a market issue, but a justice issue.
Sure.
Human beings are the ones with the rights. These rights shouldn't, when they pass the laws that corporations have the same rights as individuals, you've diminished the role of human beings. You've diminished the role of physical labor, and that's an injustice to humanity itself.
Yeah, and as what I was saying about the advertisements in the New York Times with $30,000 watches and suits for $4,000 and what have you. This is current. This is whereas some people are thinking $30,000 for a watch. I mean, I'm not going to make that this year because of what's happened in the economy. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We'll be right back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Trans-Siberian Orchestra. Two great shows, matinee and evening, December 21st at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Keep it here to win your free ticket for TSL from your concert station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
What exactly is telemetrics and what does it mean to me?
How does changing light bulbs save me money?
Where are the best places to find organically grown foods?
When will Michigan be seeing an increase in green building?
What are some easy steps my family can take to be more green?
How can my coworkers and I start a recycling program at work?
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at movingmichiganforward.com. You can also join the discussion, offer your ideas, suggestions, and advice on how we can all work together to live greener in Michigan. MovingMichiganForward.com, in partnership with Next Energy, is brought to you in part by IBEW Local 58 and NECA Signatory Employers, The Good Food Company, and Charter One.
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at MovingMichiganForward.com.
MovingMichiganForward.com. Learn, share, grow, make your future green at MovingMichiganForward.com.
If the IRS tells you that you still owe back taxes, what can you do? Or if the state tax collector threatens you with wage garnishments, penalties, or seizures, what are your options? As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Just call 800-493-8159. If you qualify, American tax relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe. Remove penalties and interest and get the collector off your case. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 800-493-8159. That's 800-493-8159.
The following is not a radio commercial. It's a gift from the people of Iceland to you and to your heart. You see, Iceland Health is giving away a free bottle of omega-3 fish oil to everyone who requests one because they recognize the very real danger of high cholesterol, heart disease, and stroke.
As a result of taking Iceland Health, my blood pressure has dropped tremendously.
Iceland Health Omega-3s offer more than just protection for your heart. They have powerful benefits for joints, memory, even your skin. And the Omega-3s from Iceland Health offer twice the power of ordinary fish oil.
I feel more flexible, and I feel like my energy is up.
Iceland Omega-3 made me feel 100% better.
Call now to request your free bottle of Iceland Health Omega-3 soft gels. 1-800-574-9485. It's our gift to you. 1-800-574-9485. 1-800-574-9485.
Are you receiving monthly checks from a lawsuit you won? Are you having trouble paying your bills every month because the settlement money you're getting just isn't enough? Well, there is a way you can get the cash you need now in one lump sum payment. For free information to see how much cash you can get, call Peachtree Settlement Funding now at 1-800-518-4945. Find out how you can turn your future structured settlement payments into the cash you need now to get free of your credit card debt, to meet your rising mortgage payments, to pay your medical bills and other expenses. If you're receiving payments from a lawsuit, call Peachtree Settlement Funding. For your free information, call now 1-800-518-4945. You have bills piling up that need to be paid now. So why wait any longer? Get the future money you have coming to you now when you need it most. For your free information, call Peachtree Settlement Funding now at 1-800-518-4945. That's 1-800-518-4945. 1-800-518-4945.
Thanksgiving Eve rocks at TNT Convention Center. Join 101 WRIF on location with live rocks and matches of Soma. Celebrate the biggest bar night of the year this Wednesday night at TNT's on Hyper, north of 15 Mile Creek Township with 101.
Oh, yes.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Jalene Jordan with me as well. At 1 a.m., I'll be doing another interview. An interesting one, this time with Lamar. What's going on? What's his name?
I don't have it in front of me. Oh, sorry.
Wait a minute here. Let me click a little button here.
I can read an email unless you...
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Kathleen wrote in. Kathy, the last UAW contract called for new employees to get $12 to $14 per hour. Why is your caller so anti-union?
Yeah.
And
Lamar Waldron, who has co-authored the book Legacy of Secrecy about the Kennedy assassination. Saturday was the 45th anniversary of the slaying of John F. Kennedy. And this book, and on my show, Lamar Waldron at 1 a.m. names who was the actual assassin and assassins of John F. Kennedy in 1963. Talk about long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, Tim wrote in, hey, Pete.
Hey, Pete.
I worked on the line at a Ford plant on an F-150 line from 2006 to 2007, made $14.84 straight time. They have a two-tiered wage system now. I also got almost no benefits from that. Yes, I was a UAW member. This 30-year guys made 28 and change straight time.
Wow.
Got laid off in July, so don't know what's going on there now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this $50 an hour, usually what these anti-union guys, and Eric, I'm sorry, I don't keep talking about you even though you're not on the line anymore, but it's this bitter resentment of people that have organized to do better. And that's not the best impulse that one has. What we ought to be thinking about is organizing a union of your own, because there are aerospace unions that do all that. And remember, the 30s was the big period of union organization. All right, let's go back to our phones, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Brian in Ypsilanti. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
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 I'm a
GM UAW worker.
Okay.
And I just want to say that Spiepel is right. We did take a recession. I'm actually the one that they just brought in before the contract.
Uh-huh.
And my brother, he was brought in afterwards when they started doing a tier two wages.
Right.
And, yes, he was getting paid 14 with no benefits. And then they let him go about a couple months.
Wow, that's almost like not having a union.
Yeah. And it's funny because when I got in there, in 06, and I wasn't paying no union dues. I was paying union dues, but I just felt like I wasn't getting no union because people with more time always fought against us like we're halved.
Yeah. Well, I think there was great resentment among many of the people in the union. And it's not a proper attitude. But the idea, they saw that everything that had been fought for by three generations of UAW workers beginning to crumble. And because what they do, they set the two-tier wage, and then pretty soon, and what the UAW doesn't seem to understand, it's the top leadership, is they're trying to drive down wages to something like $14 an hour. So goodbye, middle class in the state of Michigan. All right, thank you very much, Brian. Appreciate your call. Here is, we lost our Windsor call, but let's go. Let's go to Joe. Joe's in Detroit. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
I wanted to touch on two of your subjects for tonight, if possible.
Sure.
One, I'm a proud 10-year Teamster.
Okay.
One thing that people need to realize is I believe that a lot of the union busting, as far as a lot of the anti-union thoughts, are a diversion. I mean, it boiled down to a decision when you're in a store. Buy American or not buy American. That's why we're not competing. There's too many foreign cars on the road. People are too busy worried about saving 50 cents here and 50 cents there and buying these foreign products. So I think that's a lot to do with that. Aside from that, people have the choice to organize themselves if they want to. You hit that nail on the head when you said that. They have the choice to do that. They choose not to. Well, then that's basically on them.
Well, let me tell you, Joe, that as you probably know, it is so difficult to organize a union because as soon as you sign a few cards, then company brings in all these high-powered union-busting firms that specialize in keeping unions out. They intimidate workers. They stall. They've got all these legal challenges, and they fire people. So that's why the Teamsters and the rest of the labor movement, the AFL-CIO, and the other federations are trying to get this law passed that would make it a lot easier to unionize.
Well, see, you have the rights to do that according to the Weingarten Rights of 1975, so there's really nothing that they could do. You can fight that.
Well, you can fight it, but come on. Joe, you know what percentage of unions that file for organizing actually win? It's terrible. It's like 20% or 30% or something like that.
I understand that. The other thing is, as far as your the gay marriage that you touched on earlier, I have an uncle that's gay, that's a male. I have a female cousin that is also gay. To me, I mean, I support them, and I'm open to the situation. I'm married to a woman myself, everything else. But I support their fight, but aside from that, I also look at it as I don't look at it as a race of people or a handicapped person or anything else. I look at it as it's a sexual orientation. I never hear nobody say that.
Yeah.
To me, it's the same as somebody that's into bondage or something. I mean, there shouldn't be any special guidelines created for somebody's sexual orientation. So that's the way I look at it.
I think your sentiment is good. The analogy probably is less than perfect. It's not even, you know, it doesn't even matter because ultimately it shouldn't even be an issue. I mean, if two men or two women come before a magistrate and say, we want to get married, maybe they're not even having sex, or who cares? I mean, the fact that this has arisen, I shouldn't say, I mean, I guess it's pretty standard in most societies dominated by formal religions, that the you know, gays, homosexuals, lesbians have always been treated so awfully, I mean, even to the point of being put to death in many societies. I mean, God, in Iran, gay people suffer is just incredible. So it ain't none of our business. I think you've got the right attitude on it. But like I said, Joe, maybe a different analogy. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call.
Speechless.
Here's Steve in Davisburg. Hey, Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah.
Yeah, we're here.
Hey.
How you doing?
Good.
Great. How are you?
Good. I liked your eating our business or whatever.
What's that?
You like it? That's nobody's business.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
It ain't our business. No, but anyways, back to the auto companies.
Yeah.
And I had a guy that worked for me, a kid, and he got hired in the Chrysler. And right after he got hired in, they went on strike. And he said, man, they have no idea how good they have it. And then I know other people there, they're in the job bank getting 95% of their pay.
Yeah.
And, pardon?
I was just going to say, is that, where was I just reading that? That, so, something about the job bank and the UAW willing to relinquish that. So, I mean, it's one giveaway after the next. You know, it was in the times gone by now where someone could do this hard work in an auto plant, putting together these cars that would be sold all over the world, and all of the noise, all of the physical assault, the repetition. But they could walk out of it living a middle-class life. And now, seeing that all go down the drain, man. All right, Steve, thank you very much. We're going to go through these calls kind of quickly. We're coming towards the end of our show. So let's, and I'm not getting all the names up here, but I will just say hello to somebody. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
This is Dustin Poole calling. I'd just like to talk about unions.
Sure.
A lot of people don't realize. It wasn't for unions. Actually, backtrack a little bit. I work for the auto industry. I am not a non-union member, but I am very supportive of them. But the reason that a lot of people miss, I can't speak.
You're all right.
Yeah, you're doing okay.
You're fine.
I'm a little nervous. First time talking.
Oh, don't worry about it. We're so harmless.
All right. A lot of people misunderstand the unions, and what if the unions, like we people, would not have benefits at work. They have extremely low wages and work in extremely dangerous environments, and you'd be expendable beyond means. They would not care about you. That's what I'm really upset about.
And, you should be. And that's the way it was in the 19th century. Into the 20th century, the employers used every method imaginable, the courts, the cops, the National Guard. I mean, think about people that during the 1880s and 1890s, the miners and some of these strikes out west where the National Guard came and mowed down whole families, men, women, and children because they wanted to have an 8-hour day instead of a 12-hour day, or they wanted safety in the mines. And because it's money. It's about distribution of income. It's if you have to pay somebody for an 8-hour day, what you were previously paying them for a 12-hour day, if you have to give them benefits, if they have to get overtime, if they have to get health care, well, that is just redistribution of income. It takes the money from the employer and gives it back to the people that are there on the front lines creating the wealth in the first place. And that goes back to what one of our callers said earlier about it also being an ethical question. All right, thank you very much. Hey, call us again. You at that last part of it, you said great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we got some more calls. We'll just take them in order here. Here's John in Royal Oak. John, hi, it's Peter and Jillian on WRIF.
How you doing, Peter and Jillian?
Doing good.
Hey, great, thanks.
Hey, I worked for Chrysler in 92. I took the buyout just recently, but, they had a two-tier wage system back then. You know, I hired in at $12 an hour and it took 3 years to get up to full pay. So I don't know why everybody thinks that they just started this two-tier wage system. It's been for a long time, for 10, 12, 15 years almost.
Yeah. Well, I know what you're saying, but there's a different aspect to it. Maybe we need somebody to kind of clarify this. This was a new system. I mean, you know what? I think this was. Now, I'm not going to guess what it is. But I hear you. Yeah, the two-tier system is what decreases worker solidarity.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. And, definitely, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I've been a UAW member since 1978, but I was a Teamster before that. I definitely, believe and agree with and vote for unions, but,
ever since I've been in the union, they've been getting weaker and weaker because management, even some of the, even, you know, you're only as strong as your local, who your people are paying your local. And, you know, they're at each other's throats so much that they've just put a big damper on solidarity in the union. You know, like when I started the union at Chrysler, there were green slates, blue slates, yellow slates, all these slates. Well, that's a segregated union as far as I'm concerned, you know. I mean, it's like, it didn't make any sense. You know, you had to...
Yeah. Well, I know what you're saying. I mean, within the union itself, there was always these different caucuses, all of which wanted to have the power of the union rest in their hands with their agenda. Well, we shall see, I think. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate what you said. You know, Julian, I meant to mention this earlier. There's a new Irish film out that claims that climate change guru, as it says here, Al Gore, is an alarmist, and that those who think they are saving the planet are only hurting poor. This is a couple of Irish filmmakers, Anne McElhenney and Phelim.
I'm such a fan of the Irish.
Well,
and their whiskey.
They say this is a film Al Gore in Hollywood doesn't want you to see. And see, they've raised almost $1 million, but they need $4.5 million. I don't even know why there's this big article about him. Let me see, it's in the Irish Times. And this is interesting because they say that there's no finished product. They don't even have to, they don't have the film done. They're a married couple. They're former journalists. And this is not the first time they've courted controversy. An earlier documentary, Mind Your Own Business, M-I-N-E, contended that the actions of environmentalists were destroying communities and lives in developing countries. Well, it turned out that it was 70% funded by Gabriel Resources, the Canadian mining company that wanted to develop an open-pit gold mine in an impoverished village in Romania. Now, they claim that all this stuff about global warming isn't real, that it's alarmist, but, you know...
Okay, Sarah Palin...
Yeah, but here's what I'm not a scientist. I mean, I take the word most climatologists. There are some dissenters that say this is a pattern that the Earth has experienced before and all this. But can people really think that you can burn all this fossil fuels and there's absolutely no consequence?
Right, yeah.
Let's look at it this
For
way.
Real.
There is actually, maybe someone can remind us, but there's a way that you want to decide on the part that would give you the best results regardless. In other words, let's say that we listen to these folks and we say that global warming is all hysteria.
Okay.
We don't have to do anything. Burn coal and burn all this. Burn it all. That's right. Well, if we make a mistake, that's a problem.
Yes.
Yeah. On the other hand, if we get rid of fossil fuels, and I mean, think about all the damage just oil does in terms of spills. Forget about all the wars and the exhaust and what happens at the refinery and all that. The transportation of it is just so deadly. But so if you err on the side of what they're calling alarmism, you have a clean environment. So I don't get these people whatsoever. I think they are probably our flex for the for the oil companies or for somebody like that. Here's Craig in Milford. Hi, Craig. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, you know, I think we're polishing the brass in the Titanic. And the reason I say that is I think it's all going down.
Good
the writing's been on the wall for some time. You can't even go into the store and buy a TV, a VCR, a microwave, a fridge, anything they sell at Best Buy made in America.
No, of course.
What make the big three any different?
Yeah,
what make cars any different?
Someone said before about buying American when you make a choice. It's pretty hard to buy American, isn't it?
You can't do it. And why is automotive any different than anything else?
Yeah.
Other than the strong unions held out for as long as it could. And I think that if we're going to have an automotive sector, you know, it's going to be extremely different than it is now.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. My great grandpa used to tell me stories about the fist fights they got in with scabs at the brickyard working for Chrysler. So I come from a UAW family. I'm in a union myself.
Well, you think it's time that we thatch our roofs and just get ready to be peasants?
I don't know. We'll see what happens. But I think, you know, I think the writing's on the wall. You just got to take a look at the other manufacturing sectors and look at, you know, it's the pastest prediction of the future.
Yeah, it is. It's a little grim looking. I want to see what this Obama presidency will do. I'm not filled with great hope, but I try to be. Yes, yes. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. Lars. Hi, Lars. Welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Julian, today I wanted to talk about the Kennedy assassination. I was just watching a documentary about it on the History Channel today, and I really don't see why it would require an elaborate conspiracy for
a former Marine to a qualified sharpshooter to get three shots off at a target that was only 88 meters away.
Well, I'll tell you, they tried to get some, at the time, they tried to get some Olympic marksmen to do it, and they couldn't. You got a bolt-action rifle, you're committing one of the most heinous crimes in a society like ours, essentially regicide, killing the king. And there's, I always use this example, you know, in, what is it, the biathlon, where you cross-country ski, and then you have to shoot at a target, and your heart is beating so rapidly that it's really hard to take a bead. As I remember, Lars, you've been in the Marines.
I could get three shots, two in the chest, one in the head at 50 yards with a semi-automatic rifle in about 1 second. So I don't see why he couldn't do the same thing
okay.
over 8 seconds.
Well, when poop hits the fan, I'm coming to your house.
It was it was a bolt-action World War One gun, though, Lars.
So it's only going to be about 2 seconds a shot.
Well, wait a minute. I understand that. But you have to get right, the first one easy. Then you have to get the other bullet out of the chamber, slam it back in, and then find the target again that's moving, that you've already gotten a shot that's blown the head off of your target. I'll tell you what, listen up. First up, we've got an interview on the Kennedy assassination. The author names the people responsible for the killing. All right, thank you very much. Let me see. Where the clock on the wall? We can do it. We can take our very last call, who is from Lincoln Park. Hi, who's this? You're on the air.
Hey, this is Joe. How are you?
Hi, Joe. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, great. I just want to call in. I kind of think the people that are against the UAW and things are somewhat out of their mind. All right, so these guys make, 20, 30 bucks an hour, but also look at the price of what they're making. I mean, you can't buy a good car for under 20 grand anymore. And, you got people at McDonald's making $8 an hour assembling hamburgers. So, and those are, what, a dollar or two?
Yeah.
So there's really something wrong if the car companies can't pay people 20 or 30 bucks an hour to put their cars together. I mean, they're really doing something wrong.
Yeah, I agree. They should have done something a long time ago, and to blame the unions just doesn't wash with us. All right, thanks for being our last caller. I appreciate it. Jillian Jordan, thank you so much.
Peter, thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening and calling. We'll do it again next week. Hey, have a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, and thanks to Alex for answering the phones every week.
Stay tuned for the interview on the Kennedy assassination.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. We wanted to give you more on the riff, but we ran out of somewhere to put it all. We said, screw it. Let's make a whole nother radio station.
What's that sound?
Riff 2 is music made for the Motor City and totally commercial-free. Log on from anywhere in the world at riff2.com. Everything that rocks.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-441-6151. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-441-6151. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-441-6151. That's 1-800-441-6151.
You're faking it, and it's killing you. You go around wearing a smile, pretending everything's okay. You put up a front to disguise the fact that you're really sick with worry about your health, about your sanity, about everything. And you think nobody understands. But I understand. You're irritable, you lose sleep, and your mind is racing with fearful thoughts. You want to stop. You just don't know what to do. I'm Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center for Stress and Anxiety. I can show you how to make it stop. Please let me send you a powerful free tape that will help you discover a way to stop the painful anxiety and depression without abusing alcohol or taking medication. I did it, and so have hundreds of thousands of people just like you. Start changing your life from the inside out. Please call now.
Call now, and we'll send you this wonderful free tape. Call 800-944-1772. That's 1-800-944-1772. 1-800-944-1772.
Attention. Suffrixa is currently seeking participants with stretch marks. If you have stretch marks due to weight gain, pregnancy, even bodybuilding, you are eligible to try Celtrixa free. Celtrixa was introduced to improve skin and has now been shown to dramatically reduce the size and depth of stretch marks on any area of the body. It effectively fades even very dark stretch marks as it repairs the damaged skin. Participate in the Celtrixa trial and see results risk-free. Call 1-800-962-1055. Stretch marks can mar and damage the skin, making the body look unattractive. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen stretch marks diminish and fade, watched as ugly zipper-like marks began to repair themselves. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your stretch marks, you are eligible to participate and experience a free trial of Celtrixa. For your free trial, call this number today. 1-800-962-1055. 1-800-962-1055. 1-800-962-1055.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. People who are sick and tired of wasting money on acne products just don't work. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. Find out how to get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine and soothing spa-quality botanicals to create a powerful acne-fighting system. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put us to the test and we'll prove it. Get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now toll-free 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Are you in sales or do you own your own business? If so, I want you to think of a number. Think of the amount of money you'd like to make this year. Do you have it? Okay, so what's stopping you? It's not your drive. It's not your skills. Chances are it's your ability to find new leads. It's not easy. But what if someone had already done the work for you? What if with one phone call you could get your hands on as many new sales leads as you could handle and actually make that number you have in your head? It's not too good to be true. It's Sales Genie, the largest provider of the most up-to-date sales leads mailing lists and business credit reports. And they want to give you 100 sales leads absolutely free. No matter what you're selling or who you're selling to, Sales Genie has the sales leads and mailing lists you need. And right now, they'll give you 100 sales leads absolutely free. Call Sales Genie at 1-800-996-3695 and get 100 sales leads for free. Call 1-800-996-3695. 1-800-996-3695.
101.1 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining. Peter Werby here with you. Saturday, November 22nd, is the 45th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And it's something that still sticks in our collective consciousness. The official version of it all, there was a lone gunman who took down this popular president. And yet, the vast majority of the American people still believe that there were many others involved. And over the years, I've presented people who have examined this on their own, and to some extent this shouldn't be necessary, but it is wonderful that they've taken on this task, because so much of what happened at the beginning of the 1960s there has informed our history ever since. And joining me again is Lamar Waldron. He was the co-author of Ultimate Sacrifice, and we interviewed him just a few years ago with that. In fact, he'll remind us. In fact, let me bring him in so I won't be guessing around here. Lamar Waldron is joining us from Atlanta, Georgia. Lamar, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Great to be here again, Peter.
And remind us when Ultimate Sacrifice was published.
Well, the hardback came out in November of 2005, and yours was the very first show I did, the very first time that people heard on the air that John and Robert Kennedy had been getting ready to coup and indeed Cuba just 10 days after Dallas. And I believe we spoke again the following year when the trade paperback came out, and we could finally talk about the number three guy in Cuba at that time, head of the Cuban Army in 1963, who was going to lead that coup for JFK, and who is still number three in the Cuban government today. In fact, we couldn't name him in the hardback. Then the National Archives released a file with his secret work for JFK. We did name him in the trade paperback, made 400 changes to the trade paperback to update it. And then that kind of launched a lot of interesting things with him and with more documents coming out, and that led to Legacy of Secrecy, which is the new book I've done with Tom Hartman.
Brand new book. It's called Legacy of Secrecy, and let me just reach across the room here. It's Legacy of Secrecy, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination, Robert Kennedy, National Security, the Mafia, and the Assassination of Martin Luther King. It's a long subtitle, but it tells you what is in this book of almost 850 pages. And as Lamar Waldron said, our guest on the Peter Werby Show, it's co-written with Tom Hartman, an old pal of mine from talk radio, and one of the best talk show hosts in America today. He's on the Air America Network. There is so much here, and Lamar Waldron, you've probably already sent heads spinning because most of us have. I mean, if you're under 57, which would make you 12 when this happened, it's all pretty distant stuff. It could be like might as well be the assassination of Lincoln, probably, to the majority of people. You've devoted an enormous amount of time to this, being the main author, and so is Tom Hartman in helping you. Why is this still something that we ought to concentrate on, focus on?
Well, three main reasons. One, the main theme of Legacy of Secrecy, as we review for the first time and document from government files and people who worked with John and Robert Kennedy, is that there was so much government secrecy surrounding President Kennedy's murder that it allowed three confessed conspirators who confessed to helping to kill President Kennedy to later be involved in the murder of Martin Luther King. So we have a great example of government secrecy in 1963 coming back to horribly impact America in 1968. And so this is the 40th anniversary year of Dr. King's murder, the 45th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. But it's more than that, you know, for people who are under 40, under 30, President-elect Obama embodies just so much of the optimism that we all felt back in the 60s about President Kennedy, about Bobby Kennedy, about Martin Luther King. But just as in the 60s, you know, some leaders are using racism today, you know, to gin up money and politics, political power. And you can look in the headlines today, and there are all these things about racist incidents, a KKK murder in the South, cross burnings, racial beatings, and these assassination, not just threats against President-elect Obama, but actual plots. And I have to tell you, a couple of those assassination plots against Obama are so similar to things that we actually wrote about in Legacy of Secrecy. It's just scary. So, you know, there's a saying that goes that those that do not, you know, remember history are doomed to repeat it.
Sure.
And we would just never, ever want to think that sort of thing could happen again. But as long as so much remains secret, as long as a million CIA files alone about JFK's murder still remain secret.
A million separate files or a million pages?
I'm sorry, a million. Well, it's actually the wording right out of a report from OMB Watch, a respected government watchdog agency, from somebody who worked with the JFK Record Review Board, an official government body, is they say a million records.
Mm-hmm.
So could be pages, could be files.
A lot, no matter how you slice it.
Right, and they're going to be secret until at least 2017. The CIA has reserved the right in court filing to keep them secret long, despite the 1992 law unanimously passed by Congress to release all those files. Tom and I have exposed so much, there's no legitimate reason to keep those secret. The Martin Luther King assassination files are worse. Those are being kept locked away on the assassination until the year 2029. So, you know, for people who were not alive like I was when President Kennedy was assassinated and you had that shocking experience, but even younger people today, you know, if we never want to go through this again, if people like you and I want to see these files while we're young enough to be able to read them, you know, people should contact their senator, their congressperson, hopefully the new Obama administration, as many Democratic administrations are, will be more open about these kind of government records because there's no legitimate reason to keep any of this information secret. And as Legacy of Secrecy shows, you know, all that secrecy in 63 had a horrible effect in 1968.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Legacy of Secrecy is, like I said, almost 850 pages. Ultimate Sacrifice was almost that long, wasn't it, or longer?
That's true. Luckily, we didn't. The type, it was actually longer. The type is actually bigger and easier to read in Legacy of Secrecy.
Okay, well,
But your reader, your listener, could also, it's very well documented. It has 2,000 e-notes, and most of it is based on files from the National Archives. These aren't things somebody passed to us in a parking lot. This is files at the National Archives. Anybody can find if they know where to look. And from the interviews we did starting way back in 1989, with more than 24 people who actually worked with John and Robert Kennedy.
Now, last year, on the 44th anniversary, on the talk show I did, I said, I want to know who you listeners think was responsible for the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And please tell me who quickly. I wasn't even going to screen the calls. I didn't. And who was responsible? And also, how old are you? Because, you know, that made a difference. I would say 80%. I probably took 50 or 60 calls. 80% of the people said it was the CIA. Not a single person said it was Lee Harvey Oswald. One person said they didn't care. And then almost everybody was under 40. So no, weren't even alive when it had occurred. Yet it was still in their mind that they had an impression of it. And then someone finally said me, and I don't know whether you'll like my answer or not, Lamar Waldron, they said, what do you think did it? And I said, well, I don't know. You know, though, right? And maybe, well, after I read Legacy of Secrecy.
You'll know, and Bobby Kennedy strongly suspected within hours of JFK's murder, and before he died, Bobby Kennedy would tell associates that Clovis Marcello, the godfather of Louisiana and East Texas, including Dallas, had ordered his brother's murder. But of course he couldn't go public with that. I mean, he'd been attorney general. Marcello had infiltrated this top secret coup plan that would have triggered World War III to expose that. Bobby testified just before JFK died a couple of months earlier that you can't prosecute a mafia godfather for anything, hardly, let alone a hit, because they're so well protected. So Bobby had to investigate quietly and in secret and told associates before he died that only the power of the presidency could let him conduct the kind of investigation that could really bring his brother's killers to justice, in a way it wouldn't trigger World War III. Now, one of the big revelations we have in the book here shows that Bobby Kennedy was dead on right, and the FBI has known that since 1985. The FBI has had a full, almost what I would call a full confession from Carlos Marcello that Marcello made in prison 4 years before he had a debilitating stroke. You know, while Marcello was still alert, Marcello made this confession to a reliable FBI informant. You don't have to take my word the informant was reliable. A federal judge found the informant reliable on this matter. Marcello made the admission not only in front of the reliable informant, but also in front of another named witness. And Marcello said, quote, right out of the FBI files, at the National Archives, the FBI has been keeping secret for more than 20 years. Marcello says about JFK, yeah, I had the SOB killed, and I would do it again. He was a thorn in my side. I wish I could have done it myself. And in the same confession, Marcello admits to setting up Jack Ruby in the bar business in Dallas, getting regular visits from Ruby, even admits to meeting Lee Harvey Oswald on several occasions with his pilot, Marcello's pilot, David Ferry, who was so well portrayed by Joe Pesci in the Oliver Stone films. The FBI has had all of this since 1985. They had it before the Stone film was made, and yet your listeners are hearing about it, and they'll be able to read about it in Legacy of Secrecy for the first time now in 2008.
The book is Legacy of Secrecy, and you can go to legacyofsecrecy.com. Am I right? .com it is.
Right.
And the subtitle, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination. My guest is Lamar Waldron, and he's written the book with Air America radio host Tom Hartman. Now, there are so many little bombs you've dropped there, Lamar, along the way. Like, the suggestion was very clear that that Robert Kennedy's assassination wasn't the result of one single person either, but rather to stop him from becoming president, which I certainly believe he would have been had he not been killed.
There's a lot of evidence that strongly suggests that. Carlos Marcello's brother said about John and Robert Kennedy, told another FBI informant, yeah, we took care of them, didn't we? Johnny Roselli was an associate of Carlos Marcello, who was the Chicago Mafia's man in Las Vegas and Hollywood, ran with the Rat Pack and Sinatra and that crowd. Johnny Roselli was on trial at the time of Bobby Kennedy's murder for a big cheating scandal at the Friars Club in Hollywood. On the defense team for Johnny Roselli and his co-defendants was an attorney named Grant Cooper, while Roselli's trial was going on and that sort of thing, the lawyer who was part of Roselli's defense team suddenly volunteered to represent Sirhan Sirhan for free and became Sirhan's lead attorney.
Huh.
Sirhan's second lead attorney, who worked under Grant Cooper, was Mickey Cohen, the famous gangster and associate of Marcello, was Mickey Cohen's former attorney. So you had Sirhan Sirhan, a compulsive gambler hanging around racetracks, who had these two mob attorneys had volunteered to generously represent him for free. And again, as we point out in the book, basically sold him down. And there wasn't what you would call a real trial in that case. Sirhan essentially pled guilty and even asked for the death penalty at one point.
Yeah, he's still alive, isn't he? He's in...
Yeah, but again, as we explain in the book, it's likely for several reasons that anyone will understand if they read the book as to why he really just can't come out and say whatever he knows did today, or he wouldn't be alive today.
Mm-hmm. The book, Legacy of Secrecy, makes some startling claims. One, that there's a direct path. In fact, that's the subtitle, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination, that leads right to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Could you explain that?
Let me give you great examples. One is on Carlos Marcello, the Scott father, who was on trial on federal charges with Bobby's prosecutors at the time JFK was killed. I've talked to the prosecutors. And most people don't realize that in the weeks after JFK's murder, over a dozen associates of Carlos Marcello, Marcello's family, and Marcello's top lieutenants were either interviewed by the FBI about the assassination or were arrested. And yet, you will not find Carlos Marcello's name anywhere in the Warren Report. So Marcello basically was able to skate for a variety of reasons we outline in the book. There was another gentleman who aided Marcello in a small way in JFK's assassination, a Georgia racist named Joseph Miltier, who was affiliated with J.B. Stoner and the Klan, a very violent, racist, anti-Semitic guy. And the FBI had Miltier, this racist from Georgia, on tape, Miami police informant tape, 2 weeks before Dallas, talking about JFK was going to be shot from a tall building with a high-powered rifle. Now, the FBI botched the investigation of Joseph Miltier, this racist, who had a small role in JFK's murder. They just botched the investigation before JFK's murder and after JFK's murder. They couldn't very well admit they botched it. You know, they knew this before and then failed to prevent it. Now, so flash ahead to 1968. Joseph Miltier is collecting money each week from Atlanta's highest paid factory workers, thousands and thousands of dollars a week. He's been doing that for years, telling the people to fight civil rights, telling his most trusted contributors the money's really going to a fund to assassinate Martin Luther King, that Miltier and his three partners were actually using almost all that money to buy undeveloped mountain land just across the border into North Carolina. But, you know, after a few years, if somebody's a racist at these high-paying factory jobs, you know, they're saying, well, so I've been giving you money every week for years. Nothing's happened to Martin Luther King. So he started to get under a lot of pressure. Some of the people contributing were with the Klan, and we know what the Klan is capable of. So Marcello tried to find a hitman on his own. We outlined those attempts. And eventually, Miltier was unsuccessful. So he turned, apparently, and this is in government files that were withheld from Congress in the late 70s when they investigated, and they indicate that Carlos Marcello and the Mafia essentially brokered the hit on Martin Luther King for this small group racist. And James Earl Ray was a low-level heroin runner for Marcello's drug network. He wasn't a hitman, but he was just a low-level heroin runner for Marcello's heroin network. So we outline in the book for the first time not only who paid the Martin Luther King hit, We explain an awful lot that has troubled people for years. Most people realize or have heard vaguely that James Ray killed Martin Luther King in Memphis. Then he fled up through Michigan and Detroit into Canada. And then from Canada, he went to England, and from England to Portugal, stayed on the run for 2 months.
Yeah,
horrible embarrassment to Yeager.
And this was a guy who was just supposed to be one lone, poor racist.
Yes, yeah, any criminal. So, but there's one thing that no one's ever been able to explain. Ray had come to Atlanta, where King lived, had lived in a rooming house for just a week or two before the assassination, had no connections with Atlanta. But for some reason, when James Ray was fleeing from Memphis to Canada, if you look at a map, he made a 450-mile detour south back to Atlanta for some reason. And then James Earl Ray abandoned his car, his getaway car. And this is well documented, just a few blocks from Martin Luther King's office and church, which
in retrospect, just seems bizarre.
Sure.
You know, why would you do, you know, why not just go straight to Canada? Why come back to Atlanta? You're going to come back to Atlanta. Why abandon your getaway car just blocks away from where Martin Luther King's, you know, family and friends are? Well, the book explains that. That's because Joseph Miltier had come up from home in South Georgia. He and one of his Atlanta partners basically aided Ray's escape. And we actually name Miltier's Atlanta partner, a man who died just 2 years ago by the name of Hugh Spake. And when James Earl Ray came to Atlanta, he literally picked up the phone, called Hugh Spake. There was another call made. Miltier was able to get to James Earl Ray. The FBI was able to figure how Ray got 3 miles from where he abandoned the car at King's Church to his rooming house. It's too far to walk. And, you know, he just shot somebody. There could be a lookout. You know, and we outlined that he came to Atlanta to get the help from the people who had literally put up the money for King's assassination. That's how he was able to evade the FBI and horribly embarrass Hoover for 2 months.
You know, Lamar Waldron, there's only, I mentioned the name once, and you haven't mentioned him at all in the discussion, and that's Lee Harvey Oswald. What role, and I know this is in your first book, Ultimate Sacrifice, a lot of discussion about that. In your new book, Legacy of Secrecy, published by Counterpoint, what role, if any, did Lee Harvey Oswald in your research play in the Kennedy assassination?
Well, I never served in the military, but I was in ROTC for 2 or 3 years in high school. And I'll go with what military intelligence, specifically naval intelligence and marine intelligence, concluded, that Oswald was incapable of masterminding the assassination and was incapable of doing the actual shooting. And we cite that secret investigation in a book. So, you know, it says just Tom and I, and Tom interviewed one of JFK's closest aides, who was in the limo right behind JFK. This aide and another JFK aide saw the shots from the grassy knoll, and yet were forced to change their testimony, quote, for the good of the country. So, as far as Oswald goes, so your listeners can ask themselves. I mean, Oswald was supposedly a teenage communist, according to the Warren Commission. Vincent Bugliosi, there was a PBS special called Oswald's Ghost on the other night. Especially this teenage communist and committed Marxist. Well, first, when he's 14, he joins the Civil Air Patrol, not a hotbed of communist activity in the 1950s. Then he not only joins the United States Marines, but he tries to join the United States Marines a year before he's even old enough to. Then once he's in the Marines, Oswald goes around studying Russian, spouting love for all things Russian so much, his Marine buddies call him Osvaldovich as a nickname. Now, guess how many times Oswald's Marine drill sergeants ever disciplined him for all that spouting of love for Russia?
I suspect zero.
Exactly, yeah, zero. Yeah. So, again, as we outline in the book, again, from government documents, you know, and government officials, you know, Oswald was not, I mean, he from the get-go, his favorite show as a child was I Led Three Lives, about a seemingly normal guy who joins the Communist Party, but he's really a deep cover agent. Oswald's father died before he was born. Both of his older brothers were in the military, one in an intelligence service. So frankly, if you're Oswald, above average intelligence, but learning disabilities and, you know, not a good family background, you really don't have much hope in life unless, you know, you were to pursue something like that. And so we outline very clearly, I think, in the book that Oswald was very likely what he said he wasn't, and he was actually part of this operation, a low-level part of the operation getting ready to overthrow Castro, but that's why the government couldn't allow a lot of digging into a lot of Oswald's Cuban Missile connections, his intelligence connections. I do have to say this, that those listeners who called into your show that blamed the CIA, a couple of good reasons for that. One is because the CIA has withheld so much, like the FBI. The other is that of the dozen people who helped Marcello, Tampa Godfather's Trafficante, and Roselli assassinate JFK, all of those people, except for Miltier, had some intelligence connection, were an intelligence asset, informant, or in the case of a guy named David Morales, who ran CIA operations out of the Miami Hughes Station in the early 60s, and he was actually a CIA officer.
You know, we are almost out of time. I mean, because you've written almost, you know, going on 2,000 in books, including your latest, Legacy of Secrecy, about this whole incident. You mentioned Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor, Charles Manson, and has done a lot of judicial stuff. I interviewed him recently, and he informed me that he has written a book and was going to have a television presentation that said that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Also, what was the case closed by Posner?
Right. Right, and then there's another book out by a guy named Gus Russo that said that Fidel Castro was behind it.
So, in other words, everything that Lamar Waldron has done with Tom Hartman is just conspiracy stuff.
Right, and you know, what I say to that, and Bugliosi has me in his book, and Bugliosi says, sure, that somebody may have tried to kill JFK in Tampa in a motorcade 4 days before Dallas, shooting him with a rifle from a tall building, but, you know, that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't indicate conspiracy. So, you know, Bugliosi and Russo and Posner all resurrected a lot of theories that were discredited and disproven years ago, and not just disproven by buffs or writers, but by people in the government. And just because you resurrect an old story doesn't make it any more true today, you know, than it was back then.
Well, let me let maybe end on this. At the beginning of the show, you suggested that people ought to write Congress people and say, look, let's get to the bottom of this. And here, to begin with, two books that you, Lamar Waldron, with Tom Hartman have done, Ultimate Sacrifice and now Legacy of Secrecy. What would you hope would happen? What would, I'd say that there was, I mean, there has been a House investigation that came pretty close to saying a lot of what you did. What would be the impact, you think, on our country if finally this was the official version rather than Lee Harvey Oswald being the lone assassin?
I think it would be so great for the country, number one. You know, as CIA motto says, truth shall make you free. I'm not sure everyone at the CIA believes that, but that is their motto. And I think it would go a long way toward guaranteeing that we would never, ever have to go through this again. I think it would probably tell us things about other political scandals that still cause controversy as well, once people saw exactly who covered up, who destroyed documents, and why, and to really get a sense. I mean, Bugliosi can get away with saying these things as long as, you know, there are a million documents. So he doesn't even like to acknowledge that there are a million. You know, he'd like to say, no, it's all over. But so, again, it's only going to help democracy, you know, and help this promising new administration we have right now, if we do indeed make that 1992 law become enforced. We've now shown people involved with the JFK hit. We're also involved with the Martin Luther King assassination. So those records should be covered under that 92 Act and not kept secret until 2029. And I even talked to the man who headed that investigation, G. Robert Blakey, and he likewise agrees, yeah, those files should be released.
And we are unfortunately out of time, and it's impossible to get 840 pages into 25 minutes, but Lamar Waldron, you've done a wonderful job of giving us just a taste of what is in Legacy of Secrecy, The Long Shadow of the JFK Assassination. You can go to legacyofsecrecy.com, and that'll be the book through that as well. It's published by Counterpoint. You can also go to my website, peterwerby.com, and there'll be a link there. Thank you so much, and thank you to Tom Hartman as well. Thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much, Peter. I enjoyed it.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is right in the street. Check out Motor City's deals, and get stuff for half price. Or hear 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Websites
worldwide.
WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
What exactly is telemetrics and what does it mean to me?
How does changing light bulbs save me money?
Where are the best places to find organically grown foods?
When will Michigan be seeing an increase in green building?
What are some easy steps my family can take to be more green?
How can our coworkers and I start a recycling program at work?
Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at movingmichiganforward.com. You can also join the discussion, offer your ideas, suggestions, and advice on how we can all work together to live greener in Michigan. MovingMichiganForward.com, in partnership with Next Energy, is brought to you in part by IBEW Local 58 and NEEC Signatory Employers, The Good Food Company, and Charter One. Got lots of questions on Michigan's green future? Get lots of answers at MovingMichiganForward.com. MovingMichiganForward.com. Learn, share, grow, make your future green at MovingMichiganForward.com.
Is your debt getting bigger? Are you falling behind on your bills and receiving collection calls? Well, it's not your fault. Millions of Americans are buried in credit card debt because of a job loss, divorce, medical bills, or just bad luck. But now there's a way you can get debt-free faster than you ever imagined. Call Credit Guard of America today for free information, and you'll learn how you can cut your monthly payments by up to half.
lower or even eliminate your interest rates, and stop the collection calls once and for all. For free information, call 1-800-710-1136.
We owed $25,000 to the credit card companies. This year, we're going to be debt-free.
Credit Card of America won't just help you get debt-free. We'll even show you how to improve your credit status.
Tell me they have 10 credit cards and rebuild my credit rating.
Call us today to learn how you can cut your monthly payments by up to half and get debt-free. For free information, call 1-800-710-1136. That's 1-800-710-1136.
What if I told you that you could put up a brand new building and save up to half the cost and up to half the time as similar conventional construction? It probably sounds too good to be true. Well, just by picking up the phone, I can prove it to you. If you need retail, office, or warehouse space, or if your church or school wants to expand and save money, you need General Steel. Call today, and we'll prove to you that your new building can go up about half the time and you save up to half the cost. Dial 1-800-220-4155. We'll help you customize your building. You choose the size. You can even add the look of brick, stucco, or stone to achieve the look you want.
If you still think this sounds too good to be true, then pick up the phone and call. The information is free when you call 1-800-220-4155. Call General Steel and find out how you can put up a brand new building in about half the time and save up to half the cost of similar conventional construction. Call now. 1-800-220-4155. 1-800-220-4155.
If you own a business, you know incorporating can be a smart way to protect yourself and your assets. So the question is, why haven't you incorporated your business yet?
My business? It's too small.
Wrong. No matter how small your business, you run the risk of losing all your personal assets, your car, your home, even your entire life savings if you're not incorporated.
Incorporating is very complicated.
Actually, incorporating is easy and fast. You can do it in just 10 minutes. Call now for your free guide from the Company Corporation. 1-800-331-1461.
I need a lawyer to incorporate. That's really expensive.
You don't need a lawyer, and we don't offer legal or financial advice. The only mission of the Company Corporation is helping people like you incorporate safely, easily, and quickly. Find out how simple it is to protect your family and personal assets by incorporating. Call now for your free guide. 1-800-331-1461. 1-800-331-1461. That's 1-800-331-1461.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Peter Werby here. It's not exactly a new subject to start talking about the price of gasoline. We all are facing over $4 a gallon. We hear very frightening stories about what it could go up to. The whole idea, though, of a society that is fueled by energy, particularly oil-based energy, is very challenging to what we're going to be facing in the future. And there's been so much discussion about it on the news stations, on the cables. Certainly a lot written about it in the newspapers, but never enough for me to satisfy my information level that wants to be as deep as possible. And when it comes to energy issues and we want deep explanations, I go to Professor Michael Clare. He's Professor of Peace and World Security Studies in Hampshire College. He's the author of a brand new book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. It's published by Macmillan, and we've interviewed him a number of times on this program, and I'm looking through the enormous number of books and articles he's published, trying to remember which. I think the last one was Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict. That was 7 years ago. Let's bring in Michael Clare. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you, Peter.
Well, this, I don't even know if we have to set the foundation for this, but it's pretty easy to say, hey, this is all George Bush's fault. When he came in, oil was about $30 a barrel, and now it's over 130. Is it all George Bush's fault?
No, not really. I mean, the fundamentals are that more and more countries are increasing their demand for oil, especially China, India, and other developing countries, and the world supply is narrowing as we approach the peak of oil production and go into decline. What I blame George Bush and Vice President Cheney for is a failure to take corrective measures when they had the chance in 2001 when President Bush asked Cheney to head up the energy panel, the National Energy Development Policy Group in 2001, and to take a look at our energy predicament and come up with solutions. And instead of saying that the
age of petroleum is drawing to a close and we have to start developing new sources of energy, they said, let's go full steam ahead with oil. Let's increase our dependence on oil. And so we're in a worse situation today than we were in 2001. I blame them for that.
Well, it all happened so quickly. In 2000, we were the single superpower. The American century was going to be the 21st century, and suddenly we're worried about being some backwater power that literally only has a military.
Well, it's true that a lot happened quickly, but this could have been foreseen in 2000 and 2001. It was already becoming evident that China would become a major oil consumer back then. As their economy took off, it was becoming very evident they would need a lot of oil. And at the same time, people were warning about the imminent peaking of world oil production. People were saying that at the rate we were going, we would soon reach a point where the oil producers would not be able to increase oil production anymore. And it looks like we've come to that point today. It looks very much like we are at the point, either this year or next year or maybe in 2010, when we will reach the point where it's no longer possible to increase world oil production. We'll be at a plateau for a while, and then the world oil supply will go into decline. So these things were predictable in 2001 when Bush and Cheney took office, and they did absolutely nothing to prepare us for this predicament.
Well, we're concerned, all of us, about what this impact of this price of oil has meant to all of us in our economies, in our individual economies. If we think of it in a manner, it's like a large tax on us. It's going to the oil-producing countries and to the refiners here that eventually sell us the gasoline. So it has worked out well for some people, for some countries, and for some companies. Obviously, there's a lot of people making a lot of money off of us paying a lot more.
Yes, this is the unfortunate truth in the situation. There are winners in the run-up in oil prices. Certainly not you and me. I'm very aware of the loss in my standard of living, and I'm sure the overwhelming majority of your listeners are in the same position. But the major oil-producing countries are making a fortune off of this, and maybe you've heard of the rise of the so-called sovereign wealth funds, the accounts created by the oil-producing countries, especially in the Middle East, to take the petrodollars we send them and to reinvest that money in the United States, buying up our most valuable assets and using it as an additional source of income. So they're getting doubly wealthy, and this represents one of the greatest transfers of wealth in human history, and I'm sure it's going to have political impact as well in the years ahead as the oil-producing countries become even more wealthy at our expense.
Well, now we're looking at a situation where in order to produce a barrel of oil, it's nowhere near what it is currently, over $130. Where's all that come? What jacks up the price? I mean, we hear a lot about speculation and what have you. Why? Well, for instance, I was in Caracas, and the gasoline there was 14 cents a gallon. It's $2 and I think 80 cents in Mexico or something like that. Why this great divergence?
Now, the places where the price of oil is so low is because it's subsidized by the governments for political reasons. Venezuela subsidizes the price of oil. They're actually losing money. And you see that in other countries where oil producers subsidize oil as well. And some developing countries, India and China and Indonesia, have been subsidizing the price of oil as well. It doesn't mean it's that cheap to produce. It is true that in countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, a number of other Middle Eastern countries, the price of production is very low. But the days in which oil production is cheap are coming to an end because we're running out of so-called easy oil, where you just stick a drill in the ground and it comes gushing out, like you see in the movie There Will Be Blood.
Mm-hmm.
Those days are over because we've used up all of the world's easy oil. From now on, whatever's left of oil is going to be very difficult to produce, and very expensive. For example, the new fields discovered off the coast of Brazil. This is the only giant new discovery of the past 10 years or so. Some of your listeners may have read about these new discoveries in Brazilian waters. This is hundreds of miles offshore. It's a mile deep water, and then several miles beneath the bottom of the ocean. It's going to be very, very expensive to produce, require very complex technology. This is not going to be cheap oil.
And the equipment isn't there, is it?
No. This is going to take 10 years at least before they're ready to produce a barrel of oil. And people are talking about drilling in the Arctic. You've probably heard about that as well. This will be even more complicated and expensive to produce. That's because we've run out of all of the easy, cheap oil, and what's left will be very difficult to produce.
Well, one of the things that I, you know, talk shows always have glib answers. I always just say, look, conservation, alternative energy, problem solved, and no nukes. Will that do it?
I'm afraid it's going to be a tough transition for us, Peter. The transition to a post-petroleum economy will not be easy, and I think most of your listeners understand that fully well. As I say, if we had started in 2001 instead of 2009, it would have been a lot easier. Today, we would have been much further along that path. Now we have to start at a much harder point along the path, but we will have to make this transition. There's no choice in the matter. And it will be costly and it will be difficult. But yes, conservation will be absolutely crucial. The development of renewables will be crucial because we've used up most of the non-renewable fuels on the planet. So there's a lot that we can do and will have to do, but this is not going to be an easy transition. You know, on the other hand, I think the Americans are very resilient and are very smart, and they understand we have to make these moves.
I think we maybe could even talk a little more about that at the end of this broadcast. Michael Clare is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. He's the author of the brand new book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, which is what we're talking about, the new geopolitics of energy. You also wrote, and we spoke to you about 7 years ago, about your book, Resource Wars, the New Landscape of Global Conflict. What's the connection here? I like geopolitics a lot better than resource wars, or are they not separatable?
Well, geopolitics, the new geopolitics of energy that I write about in my new book is how the major powers of today, the United States, Japan, Russia, China, and the European countries, are all jockeying for advantage on a planet where resources are becoming increasingly scarce and are using military means, by which I mean arms transfers, military alliances, military assistance agreements, to establish ties with friendly governments in order to gain access to their resources. And this can prove to be exceedingly dangerous when the U.S. is competing with China for access, for example, to Africa's energy. The U.S. is competing with Russia for control over the energy of the Caspian Sea basin. All of these rivalries and competitive struggles are increasing the risk of conflict in various parts of the world. That's what I mean by the geopolitics of energy. And there's so much more that could be said about that. All the hotspots in the world are being affected by this geopolitical struggle.
Yet it only seems like the United States is fighting a hot war for resources, and I think of where the United States is currently fighting in Asia and in the Middle East, and if it was similarly, if for instance Russia or China was fighting a war in Mexico or in Canada, as we are on the borders of Russia and in the same bailiwick or in Afghanistan, I don't think the United States would be very happy, yet it seems those powers kind of think we're doing what we've done for the last 100 years or so.
You know, Peter, there would be such an interesting conversation that we could have. Yes, the United States is fighting a hot war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, obviously, but China is indirectly involved in a variety of low-level wars in other parts of the world. For example, China is a major arms supplier to the Sudanese government, which is obviously fighting a war in Darfur against the rebels there, and it uses Chinese equipment and Chinese military assistance to suppress the Darfur rebels. And Russia is involved in supplying the breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia in the Republic of Georgia, while the United States is supporting the Georgian government. And you have a Russian base in that area. You have American bases in that area. It feels very much like pre-World War I Balkans to me. So there are ways in which the U.S., Russia, and China are in a kind of a Cold War like atmosphere in many parts of the world today.
Mm-hmm. I've been neglectful in mentioning Michael Clare's latest book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. It's available from Macmillan. There's a link at Macmillan. There'll also be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, as we go along. At some point, it's interesting you mentioned the analogy of World War I, where at some point everyone knew a war was coming. They just weren't sure that what would spark it. But given the amount of weaponry that the major powers have, and so overwhelmingly at least the conventional weapons that the United States has, it seems that an actual conflict between these major powers seems, hopefully, you know, knock on plastic here, that that would never occur.
Well, I certainly think that that's what logic would say, and I don't think anybody in Washington, Moscow, or Beijing is consciously planning for a war between them, but that doesn't stop the leaders in these countries from engaging in behavior that makes the risk of war greater. And I say this because they're all providing arms to local tyrants and local warlords who are engaging in conflict or in provocative behaviors that is inflammatory. For example, the Russians are backing these breakaway warlords in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, right across the border from an American base in Georgia. This is very provocative behavior. The Chinese and the Russians last summer conducted war games in Central Asia through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They basically told the United States to vacate its base in Kyrgyzstan. We, meanwhile, you know, keep on providing lots of weapons to the Middle Eastern countries. We say we're going to remain in the area forever, it seems to me. So there isn't a lot of indication that any of these countries are engaging in behavior that makes war less likely.
Yeah, it certainly the contest for resources is nothing new. That's been much of what's driven wars in the past. You rarely mention India, and I know at some point, I don't know if this is your phrase, Chindia, is China and India.
Yeah.
In your book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, do you think they see us? Is there any indication in what comes out of their literature that they see the United States essentially as history, or at least in the sense that the British Empire once was the dominant world power and it shrunk considerably over the last 100 years? Do they think it's kind of all over for us?
I don't think anybody in their right mind thinks that the United States is past history. I do think that they believe that the United States as the sole superpower, that those days are over. They see the world as a much more competitive struggle in which the United States is one of one of several major powers all struggling for influence, and the Chinese would believe that, you know, in the next 50 years, China will be one of the great powers along with the United States and Europe. And the Indians believe that in that time, India will also rise to be one of the great powers. And they don't necessarily think that this has to lead to conflict, but on the other hand, they believe that it might lead to conflict, and therefore they have to build up their military forces in order to protect themselves in the event that war would break out, and they have to ensure that they have an adequate supply of vital resources, especially energy resources. so that the United States cannot cut off their supply of resources. And this, I'm afraid, is leading to a global struggle today over oil and natural gas that could prove to be the spark for a future conflict between the U.S. and China.
I wonder if India and China, with enormous populations, could actually create an industrial infrastructure that could create both what we have here in terms of military and also of consumer goods. In automobiles that have to be run on petroleum products. It doesn't seem even materially possible. The planet would probably collapse if the rest of the world, good sections, billions more people began to live like we do here in the United States.
Well, this is a great worry, Peter, and you're absolutely right to raise this question. I don't think it's possible for this planet to provide an American standard of living as we understand it for a China and an India with their population as it's expected to be at our standard of living. I just don't think it's possible. When you consider that in this country we have essentially one automobile for every adult in this country, and in China and India today they probably have, I'm making this number up, but it's the right order of magnitude, about one automobile for every 100 adults.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were to have one for every adult, and they have five times as many adults as we do, you can start doing the math, and you could figure out that supply of oil that's left would disappear in about 2 or 3 years.
Sure. Michael Clary, at the beginning, or actually towards the middle of our conversation, we were talking about what could have been done if we would have recognized this problem as it was defined by many, including yourself. In 2000, we would have an 8-year, 9-year jump on things. Now we're going to be hopeful that there's a new administration that will address these problems, and yet the dominant paradigms, the ruling models of how people function, they rarely ever altered except in times of catastrophe. There's just so much invested in things as they are. Are you hopeful that either presidential candidate, given what they've said so far, I mean, including offering a $300 million a bonus for anyone who can develop a great battery, that things will change significantly?
Yes, I am hopeful. I'm hopeful because I've been traveling around the country these past few months on a national book tour for my new book, and I've spoken to audiences, you know, cross country, north, south, east, and west, and I get the sense that the American public is very eager to see changes in our national energy policy, and I think that desire is bubbling upwards and that the presidential candidates are getting the message. So both John McCain and Barack Obama, I think, are beginning to reflect that desire in their statements. Every day they come out with new proposals, like the one you just mentioned that came from John McCain for a new battery, and Barack Obama's been coming forward with a variety of proposals of his own. I think this reflects the desire of the public that they move even more swiftly to new energy proposals. So I am hopeful that the next administration and the next Congress, because Congress will ultimately have to vote the bills, the new measures, will move much more swiftly in the necessary direction to adopt the measures that will be needed to move beyond petroleum to a much more sustainable energy program.
Michael Clare, if Barack Obama or John McCain was to come to you and say, I need some concrete proposals, we're going to have a 100-day crash program like so often is done with new administrations, to really alter the path of dependence on petroleum, are there general ballpark suggestions you could make or specific ones?
Yes. I think you have to do two things. You have to cut down our demand for petroleum through conservation. And I hate to say this because we all love to drive rapidly. I'm no different from anybody else. But one of the fastest ways to reduce consumption is to lower the speed limit wherever possible. And, you know, and also to get more buses out onto the streets to get people out of their cars. Those could be done very swiftly, and they'd reduce our demand for petroleum. That would be number one. Number two, and else, and Barack Obama has said this, is to take off table the option of going to war with Iran, because it's every time President Bush makes a threat of attacking Iran, the price of oil jumps, because the oil speculators think that an attack on Iran is going to lead to $200 or $250 a barrel oil. And if we keep talking that way, we're going to create a self-fulfilling prophecy here. Let's just say we're not going to do that, and the price of oil will come down. That's another thing we could do.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and there are so many other suggestions, many of them contained in a brand new book by Michael Clare, the author of Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. It's available from Macmillan, the publisher, and there'll be a link on my website as well, peterwerby.com. Michael Clare, thanks again for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
$9 million.
For all of you who are stuck with me.
By 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the Rip. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And,
I'm sorry.
I'm a little bit embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
How would you like to lose weight for free? Hi, I'm Steve Bostick for Right Size Smoothies.
And I'm Scott Johnson. For a few months now, we've offered an incredible deal to the public. Use Right Size Free for 2 full weeks and see how much weight you can lose before you pay for them.
But some of you haven't called, so we're offering one last chance to take advantage of this popular offer. These people called.
I lost weight within a couple days. Now I'm down 120 pounds.
A free trial sounded like a no-brainer, so I called. Within the first week, I'd lost a lot of weight.
I knew within a few days I finally found the answer. I've lost 44 pounds.
Right Size Smoothies contain an appetite manager that knocks out hunger cold. You'll see results early, so you'll know you can do it.
How much weight can you lose in 2 weeks? Try Right Size Free and find out. You could be our next testimonial.
For your free 2-week trial, call 1-800-644-1381. 1-800-644-1381. 1-800-644-1381.
Do you know the difference between the millions of millionaires in this country and you? Simple. They decided they wanted to be millionaires, so they went out and did it. So, do you want to be a millionaire? If the answer is yes, then get ready to write down a number that could change your life forever. Because now you can get a free CD that shows you everything you need to start making the kind of money you deserve with an internet business that virtually runs itself. So you're making cash even while you're sleeping by selling products you don't have to see, store, or even pay for. There are millions of millionaires out there. Don't you want to be one of them? Get the free CD from Internet Speedway and start making money with an internet business that virtually runs itself. For your free CD, call 1-800-339-1419. Deciding to be wealthy is the first step to becoming wealthy. Call now. 1-800-339-1419. The free CD is yours by calling 1-800-339-1419.
Rock and roll. 101 WRIF. WRIF HD1 Detroit. And WRIF.com.